You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
We've been living in a paranoid hallucination since 9/11. This illusory world in which we imagine that we're under attack from these very, very powerful enemies who were able to slaughter thousands of us on 9/11. And that's all, it's a Hollywood extravaganza. And yet that's the consensus reality of many people these days, because it took us too long to take apart what really happened on 9/11. It took years.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, False Flags, from Paris to San Bernardino. Kevin Barrett has taught Arabic, Islamic studies, folklore, African literature, French, and humanities at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and San Francisco State University. He is one of the world's best-known Muslim critics of the War on Terror. He is the editor of three interfaith anthologies, 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11. And his latest, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. He is the author of Truth Jihad and Questioning the War on Terror. Kevin Barrett, welcome again.
Hey, it's great to be back with you, Bonnie.
I'm reading your new anthology, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. You have 27 contributing authors, and I must say some extremely informative and provocative analyses, not only on false flag events in Paris and San Bernardino, but of the war on terrorism, U.S. militarist factions, ISIS, the media, the New World Order, and on and on. I understand that you published this volume on the one-year anniversary of the Paris Charlie Hebdo attacks. Why that anniversary?
Well, I see these two Paris false flags of 2015 as being closely related. I was actually giving interviews in Paris about the events of January 7th in the Charlie Hebdo offices on the night before this new attack took place on Friday, the 13th of November. So I think there's clearly a link between the two. There's a decision here that was taken apparently to target Paris, and there are probably many, many reasons for that in geopolitics and military strategy. Typically, people try to achieve many different things with the same move, just like a good chess player will try to achieve many different things with the same move. But for me, you know, I love Paris. I lived there for a full year back in 1989. That's right. And so when these events happened in Paris, and especially when I was first taken in by the Charlie Hebdo shooting, I actually believed the official story for a little while. It kind of bothered me. You know, I guess Paris for me is linked with all of these images of a culture that's a little smarter, a little better educated than where I came from in the Midwest of the USA. So I just was offended that freedom, liberté, you know, which the French Enlightenment gave us, is being rolled back all over the planet. They're building a planetary gulag on the back of Islamophobia, and that Islamophobia is being created with these fake attacks attributed to so-called radical Muslims. And, of course, they're also manufacturing real dangerous radical Muslims like ISIS. So the whole situation is very annoying to me. And I've been pushing back as hard as I can with these two books about the two big Paris false flags of 2015.
You begin the book with a series of articles that you wrote in response to and immediately following the Paris attack, in which so-called terrorist events were taking place simultaneously in three different locales in central Paris on Friday the 13th, November 2015. You were actually in Paris right before these series of events in November, isn't that right?
Yeah, I flew out on the afternoon of Friday the 13th, Paris time. And when my plane landed at Chicago's O'Hare Airport and we got to the luggage carousel, the TVs over the luggage carousel were full of news about this new big terror atrocity in Paris. So I guess I got out right before they locked down the borders. but yeah, you're right. There were drills going on that day. I didn't know that, of course, as I was flying out of Paris. But, you know, I actually went right by the Stade de France on the train to the De Gaulle Airport. And little did I suspect that as I was on my way out of Paris, there were all of these teams of whoever they are, Operation Gladio operatives, deep cover military people, maybe some crisis actors, all doing these drills that simulated exactly what happened. That is a multiple location active shooter event.
Well, that's very interesting, Kevin. I wasn't that aware of the drills. Of course, false flag events typically and almost always take place under the cover of drills, but I didn't realize that. Where did you read about the drills?
Well, there's a French doctor named Patrick Pelou, who was actually very much involved in the Charlie Hebdo affair as well. Apparently, he has a direct line to the president of France, and he called him up right away after this latest attack. Anyway, Pelou went on television on, I believe it was on the 13th or possibly the next day, and gave an interview in which he discussed the fact that he was participating in these multiple location active shooter terror exercises when the real thing suddenly broke out. Right on the same day. And so they had all of the emergency response prepared, and they just shifted seamlessly from the drill into the reality that was basically exactly the same as the drill.
Wow, that's a real dead giveaway. That reminds me of course, London, 7-7, 9-11, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, Patrick Pelou is kind of the Peter Power of France. Peter Power is the Visor Consultants terror expert who went on television on 7-7. That is on July 7, 2005. The London bombings had just happened, and he went on television and said he was stunned that the actual attacks had happened at the precise locations and times that had been envisioned in the fictitious drills that his company had been hired to help arrange. Apparently nobody had explained to him that he shouldn't say things like that in public. So that's the most extreme example. But on 9/11, we also had 46 drills relating to 9/11, of which 20 odd were actually happening on September 11th, 2001, which was the biggest national security special event day in U.S. history. And those drills on 9/11 included live fly plane into building exercises, among others. They also included mock invasions from Russia that sent planes up to the North Pole so they wouldn't be in place to get in the way of whatever was happening on that day. And we see this over and over and over. Drills in San Bernardino as well, the follow-up to this most recent Paris attack. We had a facility targeted in San Bernardino, a facility for disabled people, which must be the only facility for disabled people in the world that has an active shooter drill every single month. And so when this actual event broke out at this facility, people there filmed it and just assumed it was a drill. So this pattern has become familiar to us now. It appears that the Operation Gladio false flag terror specialists are very much in the habit of creating drills that simulate the attacks that they're going to stage.
Do we have any specific information about the drills taking place in Paris on November 13th? I mean, for instance, there were three different locations there in Paris. There was the Stade de France that you mentioned you passed on your way out of town, etc. Do we know any specific locales where they were staging these drills?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I don't think so. This Pelou, I believe, kind of clammed up after he made his initial statements. It's possible that a little bit more is known at this point, but it seems that these drills are kept secret, and of course the authorities have their reasons for that. They claimed all of this is part of the war on terror and has to be all veiled in secrecy. But no, I don't have details about precisely where these drills were happening.
You refer to the Charlie Hebdo attack on January 7th, 2015, as a Gladio II false flag. What do you mean by Gladio II? Are you referring to NATO?
Yes. Operation Gladio, the original version, was the wave of false flag terrorism that hit all over Europe during the Cold War. It included shootings in Brabant, Belgium, that killed more than a dozen people, I believe. There was the train station bombing in Bologna, Italy, and the depredations of the Baader-Meinhof gang and the Red Brigades in Italy. All of this, at the time, we were told, was an example of the left-wingers getting out of control. We were told there was a serious terror threat from the left, and that was one of the reasons that Europeans were reluctant to elect strong left-wing governments. Turned out that that was the whole purpose of the exercise. This Gladio wave of terror was being orchestrated by the Pentagon through NATO. NATO is really a euphemism for the U.S. military occupation of Europe. And the chiefs of NATO, that is, the people reporting to the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the American Pentagon, were employing so-called stay-behind armies, meaning a bunch of deep-cover mercenaries whose job originally had supposedly been to stockpile weapons and do military training in case the Russians ever invaded Europe. But that rationale quickly disappeared, and these assets were then used to terrorize Europe and falsely blame left-wingers in order to prevent Europeans from electing left-wing governments. And it worked famously. They were able to keep their control of Europe and avoid any of these independent left-wing parties from taking over any European countries. And instead, we had parties like the French Socialist Party, which was actually created by the CIA, the pseudo-left-wing parties, taking power. So that was the original Operation Gladio. And now we're in the middle of, I guess you could call it Gladio II. And this is this new permutation of the wave of false flag terror sponsored by Western insiders. And this time, of course, it's all targeting Muslims, or rather, Muslims are the patsies who are set up to be blamed for these attacks. It actually began before September 11th, 2001. It appears that the earlier World Trade Center bombing in 1993 was false flag. The FBI built the bomb, and we know that because the FBI informant who had orchestrated that bombing taped himself discussing with his handler from the FBI how the FBI was supposed to have given him a dud, but didn't, apparently. And he was very upset about that because a lot of people got killed. So that was one example. We had the USS Cole bombing, which was attributed to a disabled teenager in a dinghy, but which was probably actually a bomb planted inside the ship. And that's precisely what the government of Yemen said at the time. They investigated, and their report said that this was done by the Americans themselves, and so on and so forth. We had African embassy bombings as well. This whole wave of terror attributed to Muslims has been essentially fabricated by the same people who fabricated the Brabant shooting and the Bologna bombing, the killing of Aldo Moro, and the other high-profile atrocities of the Cold War in Europe. So it seems that the United States government and its deep state organized crime assets seem to have some kind of need to create mayhem in Europe. And now, of course, it's spread all over the West and all over the world. It's created a clash of civilizations between the West and the Islamic world. And unless people wake up a little faster than they are right now, it could continue for quite some time.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, False Flags from Paris to San Bernardino. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. There were three different locales in central Paris on November 13th where shootings ostensibly took place: La Belle Equipe restaurant, the Bataclan nightclub, and the Stade de France. Many questions have arisen as to what actually took place at these three different locations. Are there eyewitness reports to what happened?
Yes, there are. Well, you know, that there are, but there are also not nearly as many photographs and videos as one might expect, especially at the Belle Equipe and at the Bataclan nightclub. And it's kind of hard to tell which witness reports are credible. For instance, immediately after the events, we heard on Fox News that the perpetrators in the Bataclan nightclub had been shouting about Syria and so on. We got a supposed eyewitness reports that turned out not to be true. The same reports on Fox News told us that some of the perpetrators had been arrested, and that was not the official story the next day. So there were a number of dubious initial reports. And these dubious initial reports all seem to emphasize the connection with Syria. Later, there have been other reports, and some of the other reports, eyewitness reports, have diverged significantly from the official story in various ways. For example, at the Belle Equipe restaurant, we learned from eyewitnesses reported in the mass media that the shooters were actually white paramilitary types, large, very well-muscled white paramilitary types, which does not jive with the descriptions of the people that the French government would later blame. So there's a kind of a mishmash of eyewitness reports, including various kinds of details that both fit with and don't fit with the official story. But there's kind of a shocking lack of photo and video evidence in an era in which practically everybody is walking around with a smartphone that can take very high quality pictures. There's very, very little publicly available anyway on this. And you would think there would be more, because you would kind of think that people could make money selling it to the media, for one thing. And certainly people do have a tendency to share everything that they film these days. So it's interesting, for example, that the only photo or video evidence we have of any dead bodies in the Bataclan nightclub is this really strange image that is reproduced on the cover of the book, Another French False Flag. This image appears to have been sort of taken from a high vantage point. It shows bodies on the floor of it's the dance floor of this nightclub. And there are red smears surrounding these bodies in the shape of a heart. And one has to wonder what created those smears. One could imagine very, very bloody bodies being dragged around the floor to paint this sort of heart shape on the floor. But why would they do that? And there's actually probably too much blood. And there are other questions about this picture as well. A couple of the bodies seem to be anatomically impossible in terms of the positions that they're in. These positions would be possible if what we're being told are bodies were in fact dapper cadavers, which are fake bodies sold to Hollywood and to others who, you know, have a use for fake bodies. I suppose drills would use them as well. So there are a whole lot of questions about the witness reports, both the ones that seem reliable and the ones that have been proven false. But the biggest question to me so far is really the lack of photo documentation. At the Belle Equipe, for example, nobody got a picture of this car with the three white paramilitary guys. Nobody got the license plate. One would really think that there would be a lot more of that. And who knows, you know, whether people in Paris who are investigating this, and there are a couple of, you know, a handful of alternative journalists who are brave enough to take this stuff on, will perhaps shed more light on this as time goes on.
You mentioned this extremely strange picture from the Bataclan nightclub, a portion of which, like you say, appears on the cover of your new anthology. If people want to look at this picture, where can they find it? Is it available?
Well, most of the versions of it on the internet are not in the highest resolution that we have, but I guess if you feed into a search engine like Google Images, Bataclan nightclub, you know, bodies, French terror attacks, things like that, you'll probably find it. And if you look around for a while, you might find the higher resolution versions and the ones that haven't had various kinds of masking put over the bodies and things like that. It is a fairly horrific image, but it really does raise questions. And one of the questions is, you know, are they messing with us? I mean, why would they just leave these bodies there? You know, there's no medical attention, nothing like that. And what painted this heart-shaped smear with these, you know, 6 foot wide smears of blood or whatever that red stuff is that they painted the heart on the floor of the nightclub with, precisely what is going on with this? And I've discussed this with various people with some law enforcement and military backgrounds, and they have thrown up their hands and said this picture doesn't make any sense.
Now, you've also mentioned the lack of photographic evidence in general. I mean, with the exception of the strange and sort of grisly photograph that we've been discussing, are there any other photos at all of these three simultaneous shootings in Paris?
Well, yeah, sure, there are. And there are some videos as well. I think there's some videos of people fleeing the nightclub and things like that, but not a lot. It's kind of shocking how few there are. You know, one would think that in the nightclub itself there would be some photos and videos, but what we have is that crazy picture that we've been discussing of the heart painted in blood on the dance floor with the dapper cadavers or the bodies in very unusual positions arranged. And then we also have a very famous iconic photo that was supposedly taken right before the shootings, taken from the band the Eagles of Death Metal as they were playing from their vantage point, showing the crowd dancing to the music. And that's a very, very high quality picture. Some say it looks a little too high quality. There's been a discussion of whether that photo is authentic or not. And I didn't include the people saying it's not authentic in the book because I looked at that back and forth discussion. And when people like Massimo Mazzucco, a former professional photographer, who's quite a skeptic on false flags, looked at this, he said that photo was probably real. So in any case, there's that iconic photo of the audience. There's the iconic photo that I just mentioned of the heart painted in blood on the dance floor with bodies strewn around. And then there are these sort of a handful of these things of, you know, people fleeing from the nightclub and things like that, but not very much. I mean, there's you can't look around and find, you know, dozens or hundreds. And you'd kind of think you would. You certainly think that you would find people would have taken stuff on their iPhones from inside the nightclub during the show, during the shooting. How could nobody take any photo? I mean, sure, they're trying to save themselves, but there are a few thousand people in there. Of all those people, you'd think a couple would have taken some shots and they'd be worth a lot of money and they would go to the media, but there's nothing. So it's a bit of a mystery, and whether that will all get cleared up and maybe some photos will emerge in the future, it's a possibility. I don't know.
Who is Mohamed Boutiche and why is he important?
Well, Mohamed Boutiche, as I recall, was the acquaintance of the Kouachi brothers, who were the patsies blamed for the Charlie Hebdo event. And there were all sorts of questions about those guys, beginning with the fact that the Interior Minister, Bernard Cazeneuve, on the very day of the Charlie Hebdo attacks on January 7th, 2015, Cazeneuve said that there were three terrorists in the Charlie Hebdo offices. And the official story and all of the supporting evidence only shows two. What made him think there were three? Well, a third later popped up. You know, 2 days later, a third guy, Koulibaly, took hostages in the kosher deli. So there are all sorts of questions about these Kouachi brothers that were blamed for shooting up the Charlie Hebdo offices. Among them, if indeed they were members of Al-Qaeda in Yemen and other terror groups, why would the French police hunt them down like dogs and execute them rather than making some effort to capture them alive and interrogate them and take down their networks? And it turns out that maybe the reason that the French police had no interest in capturing these brothers alive was that the Kouachi brothers were working for French intelligence. And so we got word from Mohamed Boutiche, among others, that there are actually eyewitnesses, including him, to the fact that these guys were intelligence assets. And we have a lot of reasons for thinking that. They made all sorts of impossible journeys to the Middle East, for example, going to Israel and then to countries where you can't go if you have an Israeli stamp in your passport, among other things, all sorts of very improbable aspects of their biographies. And one of them, for example, is that the Kouachi brothers were arrested with child pornography, and then that was just dropped. They were never prosecuted. And in such a situation, when you have two guys like this who are close to supposed radical Islamist currents, you can be sure that those guys became intelligence assets, and that's why those charges went away. So anyway, Boutiche apparently had firsthand knowledge that the Kouachi brothers were intelligence assets, and he was arrested a few months ago, actually a little bit before this latest false flag. And according to some of his friends and supporters in France, they're trying to silence him, and they're trying to prevent him from publicly affirming his firsthand knowledge that the Kouachi brothers were French intelligence assets.
You're listening to the voice of Dr. Kevin Barrett. I am Bonnie Faulkner. Today is a fundraiser for KPFA, and as you may have guessed, we're offering as a premium today, a couple of premiums, two blockbuster anthologies by Dr. Kevin Barrett. His very newest one that we're focusing on in this interview, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. This is about 338 pages, I believe, 27 contributing authors. It's a blockbuster, highly, highly recommended. Another French False Flag. Our gift to you today on KPFA for a donation to Free Speech Radio of $100. We also have Kevin Barrett's prior anthology, We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, an excellent, excellent anthology, again with an array of top-notch authors, that for $100 to KPFA. I'd love to get a few of you on the phone to support free speech. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Your $100 tax-deductible contribution will get you either his latest, Another French False Flag, about the Paris attacks and also the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino. But this latest anthology with 27 contributors covers a broad territory. A lot of the articles are specifically on these terror events. Many of the articles are on the larger geostrategic military plans of the elites. Some people speculate on where this is all headed. There are some incredible authors. Of course, Paul Craig Roberts is in here, Brandon Martinez, Nick Kohlerstrom, A Paris Again Hit by Fictional Terror. That's a very interesting one about these events being presaged on the cover of The Economist, What to Expect in 2015. We've got article, another Anatomy of a False Flag by Stephen Lendman, on and on and on. Gerard O. Coleman, a young Marxist, lives in Paris. He's from Ireland. James Petras is in here. Wars, U.S. Militarist Factions in Command. Barry Kissen. We've got many people. Ken O'Keefe, Jim Fetzer, Alain Sorrell. You name it. James Tracy, Ola Damigard, Henry Macau, on and on. This incredible anthology, highly recommended. Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. A $100 donation. We would be delighted to send you this. Also, we've got We Are Not Charlie Hebdo, Freethinkers Question the French 9/11. You just heard Kevin Barrett discussing the person that has been arrested and in jail because he is witness to the fact that the Kouachi brothers were working for French intelligence. We've got a whole anthology on Charlie Hebdo. Very well done. Barbara Honecker has written a blockbuster chapter for this book. Kevin Barrett again, Anthony Hall, Webster Tarpley's in the We Are Not Charlie Hebdo. He's a favorite. Paul Craig Roberts again, Alain Sorrell. Let's see, who else? My gosh, just about a whole laundry list of people. Cynthia McKinney, Barry Chamish, Ola Damigard again, and on and on. That also for a $100 contribution to Free Speech Radio KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. 5732, 1-800-439-5732. Of course, you can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Each book, a $100 tax-deductible contribution to Free Speech Radio, and, of course, a $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA for a year and entitles you to vote in our local station board elections. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. I can't recommend these books highly, highly enough. Now, because today is a fundraiser, I'm not going to be able to play the entire blockbuster interview with Kevin Barrett. It builds and builds and builds to an incredible crescendo. 1-800-439-5732, $100 for either one of the anthologies, edited by Dr. Kevin Barrett. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Of course, this is Guns and Butter. We want to play a little bit more of this interview with Kevin today. Oh, I don't want to forget that we could use a few more of you in the pledge room. There were a few people when I came in, but we can always use a few more. At 1929 Martin Luther King Jr. Way, right in Berkeley. So come on down if you've got some free time and you'd like to socialize down here at KPFA and help us answering the phones. 1-800-439-5732. Speaking of the phones, and if you've never done it before, it's a lot of fun. And if you want to come down, the people in the pledge room will train you how to do that. So let's see, Erica, maybe we should go back and hear a few more minutes of this interview with Kevin Barrett. You mentioned two writers who have contributed to this anthology who write that the Charlie Hebdo event had a prequel and a sequel with similar scripts and themes, i.e. the Mohammed Mera affair and the Copenhagen attacks. On December 2, 2015, there was news of 14 people being killed and more than 20 injured in a shooting at Inland Regional Center, a facility for disabled people in San Bernardino, California. You describe San Bernardino as a sequel to the Triple Paris attacks. Are there similarities in script and theme this time around? And are the script and themes the same or different from the Charlie Hebdo attacks?
Well, I think we've seen a shift, Bonnie. I think that in the Charlie Hebdo attacks, which had a prequel, which is the Mohammed Mera shooting, and then they had a sequel, which was the Copenhagen attacks, we saw exactly the same pattern with all three events. In all three events, there was a two-part attack, and the first part targeted a national symbol or free speech, and then the second part targeted Jews. In the case of Mohammed Mera, which was a couple of years before Charlie Hebdo, somebody supposedly shot up some French soldiers, and then somebody supposedly shot up a Jewish school. And the same guy, Mohammed Mera, was blamed for both events, but he certainly didn't do them because eyewitnesses reported that the actual shooters of the French soldiers had white power tattoos. It wasn't Mohammed Mera. In any case, so they're a two-part attack. First part targets French soldiers, then they targeted a Jewish school. With the Charlie Hebdo events, the first part targeted free speech, namely the cartoonists. The second part targeted the kosher deli, that is Jews. And then in Copenhagen, we had the same thing. We had the first attack targeted a free speech event celebrating anti-Islam cartoonists, and then the second part targeted a synagogue. So in all three of these events, we had exactly the same script, you know, two dubiously linked attacks. The first one targets a national symbol or free speech. The second one targets some kind of Jewish target. And I think that the reason for that probably was, of course, to reinforce the same thing that we heard, or rather that the police in New York heard on 9/11 when they arrested the Israeli spies who were caught dancing and celebrating the success of the attacks, were found to have thousands of dollars in cash stuffed in their socks, working for a moving company, was well known to be a Mossad front, Urban Moving Systems, run by Dominic Suter. Man, the FBI even put out warrants on as a terrorist. These are these guys, when they were arrested by the New York police for, you know, being Mossad agents celebrating the success of their operation when the Trade Center was blown up, these guys told the police, we're not your problem. The Palestinians are your problem and our problem. We have the same problem. And that's the theme of the war on terrorists, that the Israelis have the same enemy as the West. Now, it's true that the Israelis do have a local Arab Muslim enemy. they've gone and, you know, ethnically cleansed, arguably committed genocide in the heartland of Islam, the holy land that's been Islamically administered ever since Islam began, with a couple of brief crusader interludes 1,000 years ago. So the Israelis do have a problem with quote-unquote Islamic terrorism. That is, Muslims support the Palestinian liberation struggle, and Israel faces a very troubled and dubious future. But the West does not have any problem whatsoever with Islam. There's no such problem. The Islamic world has been the ally of the West in the struggle against communism during the Cold War, and, you know, for better or worse. So anyway, the war on terror is really all about trying to brainwash the Western public into believing that the actual enemies of Israel are, in fact, also enemies of, quote-unquote, the West, which they're not. So that's the script overall for this war on terror. We saw that on 9/11 with those Israeli spies arrested saying it. And that was the theme that was hammered home with those three events in a row, two in France and then one in Copenhagen last year.
I'm speaking with author and radio host Dr. Kevin Barrett. Today's show, False Flags from Paris to San Bernardino. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
So now we're in a slightly different mode, I think, with this new Paris attack and the follow-up or the sequel in San Bernardino. Here, rather than having the victims of the attack being people that Muslims might conceivably have some kind of hatred for, like the French military in the Mohamed Merah event, like the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists in that event, or like the anti-Islam cartoonists in Copenhagen. Now we're seeing these supposed radical Muslims attacking people pretty randomly, people that no radical Muslim would ever really have any problem with. In Paris, these recent attacks targeted people at a soccer match, people at a rock concert, and people at a restaurant. So a nightclub, a restaurant, a soccer match. And these were basically middle-class, educated, mostly white French young people in the Paris attack. And then they were disabled people targeted in San Bernardino. Interestingly, the precise demographic that was targeted in Paris is the demographic that has been leading France towards a more and more pro-Palestinian, anti-Israeli policy. So by targeting that demographic and ascribing the attacks to radical Muslims, this is turning around the political dynamic in France, is steering it away from its turn towards Palestine and away from Israel. So I think that's the new pattern with these two attacks. And I think the San Bernardino attack was maybe partly done to bring the U.S. into the picture, because these Paris attacks have been propagandizing the U.S. Americans notice when something terrible like this happens in Paris. They don't notice when it happens in a place like Nigeria, where far more people have been killed in much bigger terror attacks, but nobody even blinks here, or in Syria or in so many other places around the world. But Paris, yes, the Americans will notice it. And so then if you stage a follow-up shortly after the big Paris attack in November, stage a follow-up in early December in San Bernardino, that gets the Americans and sort of the West as a whole dragged into it. But again, targeting disabled people who've never done radical Muslims any harm whatsoever, targeting young, educated French people who have been pushing their country to become more and more pro-Palestinian, this would make no sense whatsoever from any strategic standpoint of actual radical Muslims, but it makes a lot of sense from the strategic standpoint of the Zionists who want to drag the West into a war on Islam for Israel.
Did the alleged Islamic terrorists in the San Bernardino attacks have any odd connections to Israel?
Well, indeed they did. Let's see, it was the brother, I think. You know, I don't have the precise details in front of me right now, but to the best of my recollection, the couple that was blamed for the San Bernardino attack, falsely, in my judgment, had a close family relationship with a pair of Russian-Israeli sisters. And the speculation there has not been confirmed that there was an intelligence connection. We don't know for sure, but it's interesting how these kinds of Israeli connections kind of keep popping up with these events. Over and over and over, we find some sort of Israeli connection. Just for example, with the Charlie Hebdo attacks, we had the alleged radical Muslim terrorists fleeing the Charlie Hebdo offices, where they just shot a bunch of cartoonists, we're told, and they fled in their getaway car straight to the center of the radical pro-Israeli part of Paris, the center of the Jewish quarter of Paris, and they dropped off their getaway car and then conveniently apparently happened to lose their identification card, which we're told is the only reason they were caught, because they dropped their ID card in the abandoned getaway car. They did this right in front of Patisserie Restaurant, which is the local Paris headquarters for the Jewish Defense League, which is considered a terrorist group here in the U.S. And every year, the Patisserie hosts a huge celebration for the Israeli Defense Forces. So we're told that the radical Muslim terrorists chose the exact spot, right in front of the place where they have a huge celebration of the IDF every year, to drop off their abandoned getaway car, throw their ID cards down, and carjack a new car and drive away. What a strange place to do that. And so likewise, when we have this sudden close family connection to a couple of very dubious looking Russian Israeli women, it does make us scratch our heads.
The reason I brought that up, Kevin, is I happened to read on the Daily Mail that long article about these sisters. So it was just kind of a coincidence that I had happened to see that article on the Daily Mail, which is a tabloid site. But every now and again, they'll have something quite interesting on there. So I tend to check it out once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do too. I believe the Daily Mail also covered the whole controversy during the Charlie Hebdo attack, or rather the aftermath, about the whole issue of Bashab, the editor of Charlie Hebdo, supposedly had this girlfriend, Jeanette Bougrab. And immediately after the attack, the whole world was treated to these images of Jeanette Bougrab, was a former minister from the Sarkozy extreme Zionist government, publicly and histrionically lamenting the loss of the love of her life, Sharp, the editor of Charlie Hebdo. But suddenly we learned, thanks to these tabloids like the Daily Mail, that all of Sharp's family was denying that there had been any such relationship and that Jeanette Bougrab was barred from his funeral. So, sometimes this kind of truth emerges best in the tabloids.
Yeah, that's right. The attorney in the San Bernardino shooting case has stated that the government's case does not add up. What is some of the credible evidence so far that negates the official narrative of what happened there? You list 10 obvious points that don't add up.
Right. Well, I was very pleased to see that finally we have a defense attorney willing to stand up and question the official story that supposedly implicates his clients. We haven't seen very much of that in the past. In particular, in the Boston case, it's just really sad that we have an innocent man condemned to death because his lawyer sold him out. But here in the San Bernardino case, we had a very brave lawyer who stood up and said, this case doesn't add up. And among the things that he questioned were the whole story of how this couple supposedly died in a shootout. You know, we're told that the couple blamed for the shooting in San Bernardino, shot at police first. And yet their windows were rolled up. The car has had its windows blasted out, but they were rolled up. So how did these people initiate a gun battle through rolled up windows, or carry out a gun battle through rolled up windows? And the pictures of them dead show them in handcuffs. One might surmise that what really happened was they were just executed as police unleashed a barrage of fire through the windows of their car. And perhaps they were already in handcuffs at that point. Who knows? There's that aspect. And another aspect of this, and I think maybe the most important, is that we have multiple credible eyewitness reports that the actual shooters in this facility for disabled people, it wasn't a couple. It wasn't this Muslim couple that they blamed. It was three, not two, but three large white paramilitaries. And, if you hear that from one witness, that's interesting. And, hear it from two witnesses, it's a lot more than interesting. And I think we have three now, which to my mind is kind of pretty much a dead giveaway. Whether this attorney's team has been warned to stop poking around in this stuff, I don't know. But it certainly was very curious how we were told that the couple initiated a gun battle and died, yet they did this through rolled up windows, and that the witnesses who saw the actual shooting say it was three large white paramilitaries.
Well, Kevin, you also point out in your articles in the book, if the couple was really part of a terrorist network, would the FBI have let the media ransack the crime scene? The internet was filled with the mass media going through these people's house.
Yes, that was very strange, wasn't it? We're told that this couple was linked to two, not just one, but two radical Islamist terror networks. And so once again, let me emphasize, they should have been captured alive if that were the case. I believe that to prevent further atrocities, it would be worth taking extraordinary risks to make sure they were captured alive if they were really the kind of terrorists we're told they were. Instead, they were apparently executed, it looks like, by police. And then we were treated to this outrageous spectacle 2 days later of the crime scene, that is the apartment of this couple that was being blamed for this mass murder, being ransacked by media and just hangers-on. A crowd of random people followed some media people into their apartment. The landlord opened it up. There's no police tape, no crime scene tape, no securing the crime scene, nothing like that. And so they just barged into their apartment and started, you know, grabbing a Quran and holding it up to the cameras. Oh, see, they must have been radical Muslims. They had a Quran and things like this. Totally disturbing all of the evidence, assuming there was actually evidence there of any kind of crime. And many have argued, and I would agree with them, that if this were really the kind of terrorist crime that we were told it was, that wouldn't have happened. None of this would have happened this way. They would have tried to capture the terrorists alive and question them and take down their network. They would have secured the apartment very, very carefully. I mean, who knows what might be in there that could tie in to these radical terror networks. But apparently the authorities, the FBI, I guess, in this case, allowed the media and a bunch of people whose identities we don't even know, just random people from the neighborhood maybe, to go into that apartment and just tear it apart a couple of days after the crime. So this is a huge red flag.
That's the voice of Dr. Kevin Barrett talking to me, Bonnie Faulkner, about the San Bernardino attacks. We're actually talking about his new anthology, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. This is our thank you gift today for a $100 tax-deductible donation to Free Speech Radio KPFA. You're not going to hear this kind of analysis or hear about these kind of books on any other network other than Pacifica. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 to support the work of Dr. Kevin Barrett, to support this station, to keep us on the air. Very, very important to do that. In a couple of minutes, I've got, only maybe 12 minutes to go. I'm going to bring Dr. Barrett back on and let him talk a little bit about this book that we're offering today for a $100 donation, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. Now, you just heard Dr. Barrett deconstructing the evidence in the San Bernardino shooting case. And it's interesting how these terrorist events will slop over into all other areas of our life. In the news today, I read that the U.S. government is challenging Apple because they want Apple's encryption information so that they can get into the new iPhones, and they are using the San Bernardino shooting as a reason. Donald Trump has come out and supported this and said, oh, yes, Apple should turn over all of their encryption information, which would jeopardize the security of Apple users. Turn it all over to the government. But Apple CEO Tim Cook is fighting this. He's so far he has resisted this intrusion into every single little corner of our lives. That's where the government wants to go. And these terrorist events, these affect us in all kinds of ways. 1-800 239-5732. Please show your support right now for Free Speech Radio KPFA. $25 contribution makes you a member for a year. You can vote in our local station board elections. Very, very important. $100, we can send you this incredible book. Highly recommend it. I am reading it. There are some blockbuster essays in here. I'm going to bring, Dr. Barrett record a little four-minute description of the book so you get an idea of what we're offering you. We're also have another book. Oh, this is an incredible book. We're Not Charlie Hebdo, Free Thinkers Question the French 9/11. That is an anthology as well. It is very good. A case is made about the Charlie Hebdo event being a false flag. That also for a $100 contribution. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Obviously, this is Guns and Butter. Comes to you every Wednesday from 1 to 2 on KPFA. Let's play Dr. Barrett's short description of the contents of our premium today, Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. Well, Kevin, could you say a little bit briefly about a few of the authors that have contributed to your new anthology, Another French False Flag?
Well, sure. We have 27 total contributors, of whom I believe 9 are Muslim. We have 2 former CIA officers, Philip Giraldi and Robert David Steele. And we have a number of professors. Current professors, retired professors, and we even have 4 total former professors who were chased out of the academy for investigating things that the powers that be didn't want investigated. Moving to the CIA veterans, I think they're a couple of the most interesting contributors here. Philip Giraldi is a former CIA officer who actually helped me put together a piece of his. It's actually kind of a combination of 2 pieces that he'd done, one in the New York Times and one in the American Conservative magazine. And so he kind of fleshed that out and, you know, changed it a little bit. And so what we ended up with was this really good article talking about false flags in general and the Israeli false flag aspect of 9/11 in particular. And this is coming from a guy who was on the inside of the CIA. Same thing with Robert David Steele. He starts his piece by saying that, hey, I used to run false flags for the CIA. And so I know these things are real from personal direct experience. And he says, I just can't believe that so many people roll their eyeballs when they hear me say things like these Paris events look like false flags. A guy who actually ran false flags as his job for the CIA is now stunned at the inability of his countrymen to understand that false flags are a normal part of standard operating procedure for people in that community. So those are some of the interesting former, you know, intelligence guys. But we have a number of other really interesting contributors. Gerard O'Coleman did a great commentary from Paris right after the attacks happened in November. And that was viewed by over 1 million people. I think it's up to 2 million or so now. And he, of course, expressed skepticism about the official scenario. We have Ken O'Keefe, the hero of the Mafi Marmara incident. James Petras, one of the world's leading sociologists. Paul Craig Roberts, the man who invented Reaganomics and is now somewhat only about half apologetic for that. He says the world has changed and he's really come over to the left side of the analysis. But Paul Craig Roberts is one of the most illustrious people in the world. He's on the, you know, who's who list of the 100 most influential people in the world. We have Anthony Hall from University of Lethbridge, who's been doing really good work on false flags, 9/11, and so on. Gilad Atzmon, the ex-Israeli skeptic of Zionism, who's in this book actually questioning some of my arguments about false flags. Stephen Lenman, great guy. He's from a Jewish background, as are several other contributors. He's kind of come around to seeing things from more or less the same viewpoint that I do. We even have the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran in this book, Ayatollah Khamenei. He's one of the very few world leaders who's willing to stand up and speak the truth about these covert operations. I think it's wonderful to find this kind of diversity of voices, all of whom are saying that we really need to sit down and think harder about these iconic terror events that shape our consciousness.
Well, there you have it, a brief description of the book we're offering today for a $100 tax-deductible donation to Free Speech Radio KPFA, Another French False Flag, Bloody Treks from Paris to San Bernardino. 27 contributors. I've been reading some of these articles. Wow, there are some very outlandish ones, too. It's kind of nice, I was telling Kevin, that he includes a broad spectrum of opinion, no holds barred. So we've got to look at these events very closely and not hold back. 1-800-439-5732. $100 for either book. We are not Charlie Hebdo. Freethinkers Question the French 9/11, an excellent anthology. Another French False Flag, Bloody Tracks from Paris to San Bernardino. And we have two anthologies today as thank you gifts for a pledge of $100 for either one. 1-800-439-5732. I'd like to thank the people that have called in to support this show, to support free speech. You can join these contributors, these supporters of free speech by calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation makes you a member, enables you to vote in our local station board elections, which we're finally having them again. Very important. $100, you can choose either book. Of course, if you can afford $200, that would be great support. You could have both books. They're both blockbuster anthologies, both edited by Dr. Kevin Barrett. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I want to thank Tony Rango for all of his great work on the Guns and Butter website, gunsandbutter.org, and, of course, all the great work of Yaro Mako. He's been with me from the very, very beginning. So we're very thankful. If you want to get a hold of me, shoot me an email at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. And one last time, I want to give out that phone number, 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Thank you so very much for your contributions. We will talk to you next week.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Okay, January 28 was not the day the music died, but something wonderful was alive back when Paul Kantner and Signe Anderson were flourishing, and that something is long dead. Or is it? I'll explore with some help from commentator Glenn Ford, W.H. Auden, and the Jefferson Airplane. I hope you'll stay tuned. I am usually unmoved when a famous actor or musician dies. I'm not necessarily proud of this. It might be a certain moral numbness on my part, but that's the way I am. For me, February 3, 1959 was not the day the music died. I was alive on that day and acquainted with some of Buddy Holly's music. But I didn't even discover he was dead until many years later, to say nothing of the Big Bopper, whoever he was. Okay, I was only 8 and a half at the time they died. And no, I haven't forgotten Ritchie Valens. But even later, the deaths of Jimi Hendrix, of Janis Joplin, even of John Lennon, failed to make much of an impression on me. Then, a couple of weeks ago, I came across an obituary of a fairly obscure musician, one Signe Tolley Anderson. I learned from it that, in fact, she and Paul Kantner both had died on the same day, January 28, 2016. Both had been members of the famed San Francisco psychedelic rock band Jefferson Airplane. Signe Anderson was the group's first female vocalist. She left the group after their first album and was replaced by Grace Slick. Paul Kantner was a singer and the group's rhythm guitarist. Somehow the deaths on the same day of both Signe Anderson and Paul Kantner struck a nerve, moved me, saddened me, reminded me of something important we have lost. For me, Jefferson Airplane created the quintessential music of the late 1960s, the period I came of age, and changed in other ways too. My college years. The years I realized that my own government was prosecuting an immoral and evil war abroad, accompanied by stunning repression at home. With the military draft in full force, I had to decide what I would and would not do, and what consequences I was prepared to endure. I and several million other young people. Pretty heady stuff for a 19-year-old from a small town in Pennsylvania. And yet we, who ended up opposing the system, never felt hopeless or alone. There were large numbers of people opting out of the mainstream capitalistic war machine and creating alternatives before our very eyes, all around. Many, many alternative communities united by our refusal to accept the evil machine. At least most of us united in celebrating the virtues of peace, love, sexual liberation, and nonviolence. We saw ourselves not as social dropouts, but as the counterculture. Most of us didn't enlist in the counterculture completely. I myself stayed pretty conventional in many respects. But we identified with and participated in the movement, the counterculture. Make love, not war, the slogan went, and we did. We burned our draft cards and the occasional draft board's office files. What I miss especially from those days is the sense of optimism and of community, of the power of the grassroots, the power of the people. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young sang, "We can change the world, rearrange the world," and we felt it was true. That's what I miss especially, the feeling that our name is Legion, we peace and love types, for we are many, the feeling that we really could change the world. And we were partially right. We could and did. To an extent. For a while. Then it pretty much changed back. Eventually, the establishment and the war machine and the capitalism machine and the plutocracy regained the upper hand. And that was the end of the counterculture and Hate Ashbury and the Summer of Love and the chant, "Hell no, we won't go." Maybe all old men feel this nostalgia for their youthful days. I don't know. But I really do miss the feeling that the people did have some power to shape events. The feeling of endless possibilities. And I deeply miss the feeling that I am part of an alternative community. That I am not alone. There are millions like me. We recognize one another as brothers and sisters. Water brothers, we help one another. The Jefferson Airplane captured the sense of optimism and love and power and possibilities of the alternative community. The deaths of Signe Anderson and Paul Kantner hit me hard because the Jefferson Airplane symbolized and fostered the feelings of hope and power to the people and community. The feelings that an alternative world was not only possible, it was being built all around us. A better world of love and peace and justice. A new continent of earth and fire. We could see it happening locally. And the people in this alternative world looked beautiful and seemed authentic. And the sex was great. And the popular music struck a chord deep in the soul. And for me, the music of Jefferson Airplane struck the chord the most deeply. They did then, and they still do today. Here are some passages from the Airplane that beautifully celebrate the beauty of the counterculture and the power of the counterculture to change the world for the better. The late Signe Anderson is not involved in this selection. The late Paul Kantner is. I thank them both. But I think what should make us grieve is not the loss of two good musicians, but the loss of community and optimism and alternatives and hope. The stuff that the Jefferson Airplane's music embodies and celebrates. As some lyrics go, "We can be together, my friend, a new continent of earth and fire. Tear down the walls, tear down the walls, won't you try?"
Thank you.
Jefferson Airplane. We commemorate the deaths of members Paul Kantner and Signe Tolley Anderson, each at the age of 74, each of cancer, each died on January 28, 2016. We heard parts of the Airplane's songs We Can Be Together and Volunteers. My thoughts about this seminal counterculture rock band triggered a few other thoughts. Several weeks ago, I saw Stanley Nelson's new documentary film, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. The Black Panthers and the Jefferson Airplane were from about the same period. The Panthers were an anti-establishment, grassroots, black power group, and remarkably effective in gaining members and followers. Enough to scare the bejesus out of J. Edgar Hoover and his clones in urban police departments coast to coast, notably Chicago. With the help of the FBI, Chicago's cops attacked and killed the charismatic and effective Panther leader, Fred Hampton, as he slept in his own bed. This assassination came as no great surprise to the Panthers, or to the white members of the counterculture. Many of them had recently had their heads bashed by the Chicago cops while peacefully protesting outside the site of the 1968 Democratic Convention. The lines I quoted a few minutes ago from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young were referring to this incident in Chicago. And we shall hear more about the Chicago police today, in a moment, from Glenn Ford. Some things never seem to change. Watching the Black Panthers movie, I was struck again by how beautiful the counterculture types looked. The Panthers, male and female, with their youth and their bearing that proclaimed strength and self-confidence and personal power. And those beautiful afros, as the natural hairstyle was called. A popular slogan of the time was, "Black is beautiful." And it was. The Jefferson Airplane and the counterculture it represented also made me think of Occupy Wall Street. October 2011 is when this movement began. It was small, perhaps, but quite reminiscent of the late 1960s. It came 43 years after 1968. But 2011 was the first time that large numbers of American people were acting like we did back when Jefferson Airplane was singing We Can Be Together. My heart leapt up when I beheld this rainbow in the sky. And you know it takes a lot to get me quoting Wordsworth. In recent days, we've also seen grassroots rebellion, a lot of it in a lot of places, by black people. Outraged at the callous indifference and the violence the establishment is inflicting upon them. Police killings of black people especially, and not that only. A new wrinkle is that today many more black people are holding government office than they did back in the late 1960s, including the highest elected government office. However, that representation has made precious little difference to the average black citizen, or to anyone else. Commentator Glenn Ford has talked for years of how very many black office holders have sold out their constituents and aligned themselves with the establishment. Ford refers to them as the black misleadership class. But sometimes the power of the people and the outrage of the people gets strong enough that even their elected misleaders are forced to do the right thing, to an extent. Here is Glenn Ford with a brief commentary. It is titled, Youth Leads the Struggle in Chicago.
Chicago Sun-Times columnist Lynn Sweet said she hadn't seen Mayor Rahm Emanuel so shaken in 20 years as when he was forced to fire his police superintendent, Gary McCarthy, this week. It seemed as if the protective shield of black misleadership class collaboration that has for the last 30 years insulated white mayors from the wrath of Chicago's outraged black rank and file had suddenly been stripped away. Black ministers joined militant youth in marching down the city's Magic Mile Michigan Avenue shopping district, demanding that heads roll for hiding video evidence in the death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, shot 16 times by Officer Jason Van Dyke. For 400 days, Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez refused to indict the cop or release the police dashboard video of the shooting or to explain why another critical video had apparently been destroyed. Alvarez finally bowed to pressure and a court order indicting the cop for first-degree murder and releasing the death video. But the community's rage could not be contained. The Black Caucus of Chicago's Board of Aldermen demanded that Police Superintendent McCarthy resign. So did Reverend Jesse Jackson and even Bobby Rush, the sellout black congressman who's been a dependable servant of the Emanuel administration. The strength of the movement in Chicago can be measured by the fact that so many elements of the black collaborationist political class have been forced to take a stance in opposition to Mayor Emanuel and the white corporate forces that he represents, and ultimately to compel the mayor to fire his favorite cop. However, if left to their own devices, if allowed to seize control of what is essentially a black youth political rebellion, the black misleaders will smother the movement in proceduralisms and long drawn-out studies and compliant advisory boards and all manner of other diversions, as they have always done. That's their job as the black junior partners in the permanent white corporate state. The young people that are the soldiers of this struggle understand that movements are defined by their demands. In a joint statement by the Black Youth Project 100, We Charge Genocide, Asada's Daughters, the Let Us Breathe Collective, and a Black Lives Matter chapter, they declared that indicting cops does not change the policies that promote the violence and trauma inherent in the Chicago Police Department. They want Rahm Emanuel's resignation, too. The Black Youth Project also demands defunding of the Chicago Police and investment of those dollars in the black community. They call for reparations for slavery, Jim Crow, and mass black incarceration, an end to all profit in the criminal justice system, a guaranteed income for all, a federal jobs program, and freedom from discrimination for all workers, and an end to displacement of black people through gentrification. These are demands for social transformation, demands that will put the young activists on a collision course with the black misleadership class, who are the first line of defense for the white ruling class, and who will soon close ranks in Chicago and elsewhere to try to stop this movement. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
In Chicago, bad cops serving a corrupt municipal government, which in turn serves the corrupt ruling elite. As it is today, so it was in my day, and so it was in Chicago long before that, too. Hey, I never said that 1968 was paradise, just that there was something wonderful in the air, and it wasn't just tetrahydrocannabinol either. The scent of freedom was in the air, and possibility, and alternatives, and a new world with more love and less violence and no more war. There was a big war going on at the time in Vietnam, but we had hopes of bringing it to an end, starting with ending our own individual complicity right now. And in fact, the people eventually did stop that war. Of course, in 1968, as now, many American people had no sympathy for the counterculture. Many people were trained to be passive and obedient, trained to obey all authority, to blindly follow custom, to not make waves, to keep their noses clean, to conform in all ways. All the corporate-controlled media urged them to stay the course, and so did all the established mainstream churches, to say nothing of the Boy Scouts. I, too, was brought up to be like that. I changed a lot when I went off to college. Others didn't. W. H. Auden has a nice poem satirizing the unthinking, obedient conformists that the government and the corporate elite want the citizens to become. I discovered the poem about the same time I discovered the Jefferson Airplane, 1968 or 69. It's called The Unknown Citizen. Auden wrote it in 1939, just before World War II. But it wasn't Hitler that Auden was trying to warn us about. In this poem, he imagines a monument that the establishment erects, celebrating the ideal, conformist, unthinking, obedient dolt that the establishment wants the average citizen to be. The opposite of the 1960s counterculture. The poem's words are the supposed inscription on this grand monument, honoring the ideal, patriotic, obedient non-entity. No draft card burner, he. It's good satire, down to the bad meter and rhymes. Just what you'd expect from a government bureaucrat. Let me read it. The Unknown Citizen. To JS/07/M/378, this marble monument is erected by the state. He was found by the Bureau of Statistics to be one against whom there was no official complaint, and all the reports on his conduct agree that, in the modern sense of an old-fashioned word, he was a saint, for in everything he did, he served the greater community. Except for the war, till the day he retired, he worked in a factory and never got fired, but satisfied his employers, Fudge Motors, Inc. Yet he wasn't a scab or odd in his views, for his union reports that he paid his dues. Our report on his union shows it was sound. And our social psychology workers found that he was popular with his mates and liked to drink. The press are convinced that he bought a paper every day, and that his reactions to advertisements were normal in every way. Policies taken out in his name prove that he was fully insured, and his health card shows that he was once in the hospital but left it cured. Both producers' research and high-grade living declare he was fully sensible to the advantages of the installment plan, and had everything necessary to the modern man, a phonograph, a radio, a car, and a Frigidaire. Our researchers into public opinion are content that he held the proper opinions for the time of year. When there was peace, he was for peace. When there was war, he went. He was married and added 5 children to the population, which our eugenist says was the right number for a parent of his generation, and our teachers report that he never interfered with their education. Was he free? Was he happy? The question is absurd. Had anything been wrong, we should certainly have heard. With W. H. Auden's The Unknown Citizen, we end our eulogy for a better time, a period when the 99% was not so beaten down, depressed, and oppressed as we seem today. Or maybe things aren't quite so bad as all that. Maybe Occupy Wall Street was more than just a flash in the pan. As Glenn Ford notes, the black citizens are getting mighty fed up and taking to the streets, demanding change, and people of other colors are joining them, too. Maybe the late 1960s is not ancient history after all. We can only hope. In any case, rest in peace, Paul Kantner and Signe Tolle Anderson. Thank you for listening to New World Notes, broadcasting from all along the Watchtower here in Darkest Connecticut. On the web, find us at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimate non-carborundum. War is not healthy for children and other living things. Tune in, turn on, and please come back again next week. Power to the people. Right on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you're going to hear the second and final part of James Corbett's report on the financial evidence surrounding 9/11. And I'll tell you about our first progressive movie night of 2016 coming up at the end of February. So let's begin with James Corbett.
Perhaps the most frank admission of insider trading is notable for three things. It was recorded on video. It has never been investigated by any agency or law enforcement official. And it was made by former CIA agent and frequent foreign policy commentator Robert Baer, the real-life inspiration for the character portrayed by George Clooney in Syriana. Talking to citizen journalists after a speaking event in Los Angeles in 2008, Baer was recorded on video making a startling assertion about 9/11 insider trading.
And the last thing I would leave you with is National Reconnaissance Office was running a drill of a plane crash into their building. And you know they're staffed by DOD and CIA.
I know the guy that went into his broker in San Diego and said, cash me out, it's going down tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah.
That tells us something.
Wow. What?
That tells us something.
Well, his brother worked at the White House.
This truly remarkable statement bears further scrutiny. If Baer is to be believed, a former CIA agent has firsthand knowledge that a White House insider had foreknowledge of the attacks. And to this day, not only has Baer never revealed the identity of this person, but no one has questioned him about his statement or even attempted to pursue this lead. So how is it possible that the SEC overlooked, ignored, or simply chose not to pursue such leads in their investigation? The only possible answer, of course, is that the investigation was deliberately steered away from such persons of interest and any connections that would lead back to foreknowledge by government agencies, federal agents, or their associates in the business world. Unfortunately, we will likely never see documentary evidence of that from the commission itself. One researcher requesting access under the Freedom of Information Act to the documentary evidence that the 9/11 Commission used to conclude that there had been no insider trading received a response that stated that the potentially responsive records have been destroyed. Instead, we are left with sources that refuse to be identified, saying that CBOE records of pre-9/11 options trading have been destroyed, and secondhand accounts of traders who had heard talk of an event in advance of 9/11. In a roundabout way, perhaps the 9/11 Commission reveals more than it lets on when it tries to dismiss key insider trades with the pithy observation that the traders had no conceivable ties to Al-Qaeda. If those with foreknowledge of the attacks weren't connected to Al-Qaeda, what does that say about the identity of the real 9/11 perpetrators?
ABC News has now learned that the Chicago Board of Options Exchange launched their investigation into the unusual trading last week. That may have given them enough time to stop anyone from profiting from death here in the U.S. It may also give investigators, Peter, a hot trail that might lead them to the terrorists.
Thanks very much. As a reminder of the complications here, though, the Secretary of the Treasury said today of this investigation, you've got to go through 10 veils before you get to the real source. Yep.
P-TECH was a Quincy, Massachusetts-based company specializing in enterprise architecture software, a type of powerful computer modeling program that allows large-scale organizations to map their systems and employees and to monitor them in real time. The person running this software has a god's-eye view of processes, personnel, and transactions, and even the ability to use this data to foresee problems before they happen and to intervene to stop them from happening. As a senior consultant working on risk management for J.P. Morgan at the time of 9/11, Indira Singh was looking for exactly this type of software to implement the bank's next-generation risk blueprint. In her search for the ultimate risk management software, P-TECH's name was floated as the best candidate for the task.
I had a good life. I did risk at J.P. Morgan Chase. Just to take a break from all the heavy stuff, what I do was to devise a way to monitor everything going on in a very large company to stop big problems from happening. There's that little cloud there and my very bizarre picture of how I think about this problem. I am a person who was merging two disciplines, risk management and something called enterprise architecture, which is fairly esoteric, but at the end of the day, we seek to prevent large problems from happening anywhere in a large global enterprise. At J.P. Morgan, I was working on the next generation risk blueprint, which is all about how to prevent these things from happening. Bad business practice, such as money laundering, road trading, and massive computer failures, anything you could imagine would go wrong. I had a lot of leeway consulting as a senior risk architect to think out of the box and actually get my ideas implemented. I was funded out of a strategic fund. I reported to the directors, and I was pretty happy. J.P. Morgan thought very highly of me, and they were thinking of funding, in conjunction with my project in D.C., the next generation risk software. What I needed to do, what I did, was a really smart piece of software. Really, really smart. Its job would be to think about all the information. And this is where you may connect a dot. The job of this software would be to think about all the information that represented what was going on in the enterprise at any given time, as bank business was being transacted worldwide. For example, it would be a surveillance software that would look for trading patterns that indicated someone was up to no good and then do something about it, send a message somewhere, send the transaction information somewhere, perhaps shut their system down, perhaps shut another system down, perhaps start something else up elsewhere. This kind of capability is very, very essential in today's world. However, this kind of software is not found in Microsoft or not even in IBM. A small group of very esoteric software companies make this kind of enterprise software, and it is very pricey. So you can't afford to pick wrong. And I asked all my colleagues who are industry gurus, what would they recommend for this? My buddies recommended P-TECH.
Indeed, it's not difficult to see why P-TECH came so highly recommended. Given the nature of this sensitive risk management work, only a company with experience delivering software to large-scale organizations with secrets to protect would fit the bill, and in this regard, P-TECH did not disappoint. Their client roster included a veritable who's who of top-level corporate and governmental clients: the FBI, the IRS, NATO, the Air Force, the Naval Air Command, the Departments of Energy and Education, the Postal Service, the U.S. House of Representatives, the Department of Defense, the Secret Service, even the White House. From the inner sanctum of the White House to the headquarters of the FBI, from the basement of the FAA to the boardroom of IBM, some of the best secured organizations in the world, running on some of the most protected servers housing the most sensitive data, welcomed P-TECH into their midst. P-TECH was given the keys to the cyber kingdom to build detailed pictures of these organizations, their weaknesses and vulnerabilities, and to show how these problems could be exploited by those of ill intent. But like all such systems, it could be exploited by those of ill intent for their own purposes, too. Given the nature of the information and secrets being kept by its clients, it should come as no surprise that many of PTEC's top investors and employees were men with backgrounds that should have been raising red flags at all levels of the government. And as it turns out, at least one of these men did raise red flags with a pair of diligent FBI field agents. In the late 1990s, Robert Wright and John Vincent, FBI special agents in the Chicago field office, were running an investigation into terrorist financing called Vulgar Betrayal. From the very start, the investigation was hampered by higher-ups. They were not even given access to the computer equipment needed to carry out their work. Through Wright and Vincent's foresight and perseverance, however, the investigation managed to score some victories, including seizing $1.4 million in terrorist funds. According to Wright,
"These funds were linked directly to Saudi businessman Yassin Qadi."
Yassin al-Qadi is a multimillionaire businessman and philanthropist who, according to Business Associates, liked to boast of his relationship with former Vice President Dick Cheney. But in the late 1990s, he was sanctioned by the UN Security Council for his suspected links to al-Qaeda, and after 9/11 he was put on a terrorist watch list by the U.S. Treasury for his suspected ties to terrorist financing. During the 1990s, as Vulgar Betrayal was being thwarted from opening a criminal investigation into his activities, the Qadi-backed investment firm Sarmony Limited became an angel investor to a software startup called PTEC, providing $5 million of the initial $20 million of capital that got PTEC off the ground. At the time, PTEC's CEO denied that al-Qadi had any involvement with the company other than his initial investment, but the FBI now maintains he was lying, and that in fact al-Qadi continued investing millions of dollars in the company through various fronts and investment vehicles. Company insiders told FBI officials that they were flown to Saudi Arabia to meet PTEC's investors in 1999, and that al-Qadi was introduced as one of the owners. It has also been reported that Hussein Ibrahim, PTEC's chief scientist, was al-Qadi's representative at PTEC, and al-Qadi's lawyers have admitted that al-Qadi's representatives may have continued to sit on PTEC's board even after 9/11. Ibrahim himself was a former president of BMI, a New Jersey-based real estate investment firm that was also one of the initial investors in PTEC and provided financing for PTEC's founding loan. PTEC leased office space and computer equipment from BMI, and BMI shared office space in New Jersey with Qadi International, owned and operated by none other than Yassin al-Qadi. In 2003, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark said, "BMI held itself out publicly as a financial services provider for Muslims in the United States. Its investor list suggests the possibility this facade was just a cover to conceal terrorist support." Suhail Lahir was PTEC's chief architect. When he wasn't writing the software that would provide PTEC with detailed operational blueprints of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. government, he was writing articles in praise of Islamic holy war. He was also fond of quoting Abdullah Azzam, Osama bin Laden's mentor, and the head of Maktab al-Kidamat, which was the precursor to al-Qaeda. That such an unlikely cast of characters were given access to some of the most sensitive agencies in the U.S. federal government is startling enough. That they were operating software that allowed them to map, analyze, and access every process and operation within these agencies for the purpose of finding systemic weak points is equally startling. Most disturbing of all, though, is the connection between PTEC and the very agencies that so remarkably failed in their duty to protect the American public on September 11th, 2001.
Could you describe the relationship of PTEC with the FAA? Now, PTEC worked with the FAA for several years, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, they worked the FAA. There was it was a joint project between PTEC and MITRE, and they were looking at, it's interesting, they were looking at basically holes in the FAA's interoperability with responding with other agencies, law enforcement, in the case of an emergency such as a hijacking. So they were looking for the escalation process, what people would do, how they would respond in case of an emergency, and find the holes and make recommendations to fix it. Now, if anyone was in a position to understand where the holes were, PTEC was, and that's exactly the point. If anybody was in a position to write software to take advantage of those holes, it would have been PTEC.
Now, was there a reference to PTEC having operated in the basement out of the FAA?
Yes. Now, typically, because the scope of such projects are so overarching and wide-ranging, when you are doing an enterprise architecture project, you pretty much have access to how anything in the organization is being done, where it's being done, on what systems, what the information is, and you pretty much have carte blanche. Now, if it's a major project that
span several years, the team that comes in has literally access to almost anything that they want because you're operating on a blueprint level, on a massive scale. So, yes, they were everywhere, and I was told that they were in places that required clearances. I was told that they had log-on access to FAA flight control computers. I was told that they had passwords to many computers that you may not on the surface think has anything to do with finding out holes in the system. But let's say you've said, okay, you isolated a part of a process, of a notification process that was mediated by a computer, and you wanted to investigate it further, then you would typically get log-on access to that computer. And from that, back upstream or downstream, so who knows? From my own experience, I could have access to almost anything I wanted to in JPMorgan Chase and didn't. For the reason if anything went wrong, I didn't want to have the access. But if you were up to no good as an enterprise architect with such a mandate, you typically could have anything you wanted.
So who was really behind PTEC? Did Ziadi, Ibrahim, and the others somehow evade the due diligence of all of the government agencies and multinational corporations that PTEC contracted with? Did PTEC just happen to end up working on the interoperability of the FAA and the Pentagon systems on the morning of 9/11? Did Al-Qadi's friend Dick Cheney really know nothing of Qadi's connections or activities? Was this all some devious Al-Qaeda plot to infiltrate key systems and agencies of the U.S. government? Not according to the people who were really investigating the company. So what did the 9/11 Commission have to say about PTEC? Absolutely nothing. The co-chair of the commission, Thomas Kane, had been involved in a $24 million real estate transaction with BMI, one of the PTEC investors, but no mention was made of that at the time, and the commission never looked into PTEC or its activities on 9/11. Meanwhile, Cheney's friend Al-Qadi has since been removed from the Swiss, European, UN Security Council, and US Treasury terrorist sanctions lists. And Robert Wright? After Vulgar Betrayal was shut down, the FBI did eventually raid PTEC's offices in December of 2002, but not before the company was given 2 weeks' advance warning of the raid. The very next day, then-Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge declared that PTEC in no way jeopardizes the security of the country. Osama Ziadi is still wanted by the FBI for lying about Al-Qaeda's involvement with the company, but the case is now cold.
Now there's an interesting twist to all of this. According to 9/11 researcher Christopher Bolin, the PTEC software company was actually a disguised Israeli intelligence operation. And you can learn more about that by reading Christopher Bolin's latest book called Solving 9/11. And now back to James Corbett.
On September 10th, 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld declared a new war. Not a war on a shadowy terrorist organization in Afghanistan, or even a war on terror itself, but a war on the Pentagon.
The adversary is closer to home. It's the Pentagon bureaucracy.
Perhaps it is no surprise that Rumsfeld felt compelled to declare a war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy. The issue of the Pentagon's $2.3 trillion accounting nightmare had been dogging him since his confirmation hearings in January of 2001. Although Rumsfeld was interested in pushing forward a modernization of the military that was projected to cost an additional $50 billion in funding, that agenda was politically impossible in the face of the Department of Defense's monumental budget problem.
How can we seriously consider a $50 billion increase in the defense budget when DOD's own auditors say the department cannot account for $2.3 trillion in transactions in 1 year alone? Now, my question to you is, Mr. Secretary, what do you plan to do about this?
Decline the nomination. Oh, Senator, I have heard...
I don't want to see you do that.
We'll stand adjourned in that case.
Senator, I have heard some of that and read some of that. That the department is not capable of auditing its books. It is, I was going to say, terrifying.
Terrifying only begins to describe the problem. The Department of Defense's own Inspector General report for fiscal year 1999 noted that the Defense Finance and Accounting Service had processed $7.6 trillion of department-level accounting entries in that year. Of that amount, only $3.5 trillion could be properly accounted for, $2.3 trillion in transactions were fudged to make entries balance, run through without proper documentation, or made up entirely. The Inspector General's office did not even examine the other $1.8 trillion in transactions because they did not have adequate time or staff to review them. In 2002, one DFAS accountant blew the whistle on the problem and the cover-up that was underway to stop investigators from finding out where the money went.
According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
$2.3 trillion, with a T. That's $8,000 for every man, woman, and child in America. To understand how the Pentagon can lose track of trillions, consider the case of one military accountant who tried to find out what happened to a mere $300 million.
We know it's gone, but we don't know what they spent it on.
Jim Minnery, a former Marine turned whistleblower, is risking his job by speaking out for the first time about the millions he noticed were missing from one defense agency's balance sheets. Minnery tried to follow the money trail, even crisscrossing the country looking for records.
The director looked at me and he says, "Why do you care about this stuff?" It took me aback, you know. My supervisor asked me why I care about doing a good job. So
he was reassigned and says officials then covered up the problem by just writing it off.
As controller of the Pentagon from 2001 to 2004, Dov Zakheim was the man tasked with solving this problem.
There are all kinds of long-standing rules and regulations about what you can do and what you can't do. I know Dr. Zakheim's been trying to hire CPAs because the financial systems of the department are so snarled up that we can't account for some $2.6 trillion in transactions that exist, if that's believable. And yet we're told that we can't hire CPAs to help untangle it in many respects.
Mr. Secretary, the first time and the last time that Dov Zakheim and I broke bread together, he told me he'd have a handle on that $2.6 trillion by now, but we'll discuss that a little.
You've got a handle, it's just a little hot.
From 1987 to 2001, Zakheim headed SPC International, a subsidiary of System Planning Corporation, a defense contractor providing air warfare, cybersecurity, and advanced military electronics to the Department of Defense and DARPA. SPC's radar physics laboratory developed a remote control system for airborne vehicles that they were marketing to the Pentagon prior to 9/11. Zakheim was also a participant in drafting Rebuilding America's Defenses, a document that called for a sweeping transformation of the U.S. military, including the implementation of the $50 billion missile defense program and increased use of specialized military technologies. The paper even noted how advanced forms of biological warfare that can target specific genotypes may transform biological warfare from the realm of terror to a politically useful tool. Rebuilding America's Defenses was a white paper produced by the Project for the New American Century, a group founded in 1997 with the goal of projecting American global dominance into the 21st century. Joining Zakheim in the group were a host of other neocons who ended up populating the Bush administration, including Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, Jeb Bush, and Donald Rumsfeld. In their September 2000 document, the group lamented that their plan for transforming the military was not likely unless a defining event took place, one that would galvanize public opinion. The process of transformation, even if it brings revolutionary change, is likely to be a long one, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, like a new Pearl Harbor.
We know that the thing that tends to register on people is fear. And we know that that tends to happen after there's a Pearl Harbor. Tends to happen after there's a crisis. And that's too late for us. We've got to be smarter than that. We've got to be wiser than that. We have to be more forward-looking. There's a wonderful book on Pearl Harbor by Roberta Wohlstetter and a foreword by Dr. Schelling that talks about this problem of seeing things happen and not integrating them in your mind and saying, yes, we need to be doing something about that now, that I reread periodically because it's so important.
And on 9/11/2001, America received its new Pearl Harbor. The attack on the Pentagon struck Wedge 1 on the west side of the building. An office of the U.S. Army called Resource Services Washington had just moved back into Wedge 1 after renovations had taken place there. The office was staffed with 45 accountants, bookkeepers, and budget analysts. 34 of them were killed in the attack. A 2002 follow-up report from the DOD Inspector General on the missing trillions noted that a further $1.1 trillion in made-up accounting entries were processed by the Pentagon in fiscal year 2000, but they did not even attempt to quantify the missing funds for 2001. The Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, later explained they were unable to produce a financial report for 2001 at all due to the loss of financial management personnel sustained during the September 11th terrorist attack. Before becoming Secretary of the Army, Thomas White was a senior executive at Enron. Enron was one of the largest energy companies in the world, posting a $111 billion profit in 2000, before being exposed as an elaborate corporate accounting fraud in 2001. The SEC, which investigated the Enron scandal, occupied the 11th to 13th floors in World Trade Center Building 7, and their offices were destroyed on 9/11. Destroying 3,000 to 4,000 documents on active investigations in the process. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon's bureaucracy did not yield the results he promised. By 2013, the unaccountable money in the Pentagon's coffers had reached $8.5 trillion.
The latest scandal to hit Washington comes from a report revealing the Pentagon misplaced $8.5 trillion. Military leaders have also been found ordering subordinates to doctor books to hide the missing money. This is the conclusion of a special report by Reuters. One former Pentagon employee, Linda Woodford, said she spent 15 years there falsifying financial records. Woodford had a job checking Navy accounting records against figures supplied by the Treasury Department. She said money was missing from the report every month.
And national security expert Steve Miles is here with me to help us crunch these numbers. $8.5 trillion unaccounted for?
It's a lot of money. This is the kind of thing that you would think would bring Capitol Hill to a screeching halt. There'd be hearings kind of almost daily. You'd have various committees looking into it. None of that. It just leads to massive waste, and there can be all sorts of fraud that you don't know about. Just one example, when the Inspector General looked at Iraq, which was, you know, a lot of money, but in the grand scheme, just a portion of the money the U.S. spends. What they found was about $50 billion of the money the U.S. spent there was wasted. And about $6 billion was completely lost. They had no idea where it went. It was completely unaccounted for. But put that in perspective, that's about this amount of money that other countries would spend on their defense in a year total. And that's just the loose pocket change that we lost in the couch.
One thing I found very interesting in this report is that the Pentagon apparently uses a standard operating procedure to enter false numbers. Or so-called plugs to cover lost or missing information in their accounting in order to submit a balanced budget to the Treasury. So they can write in everything.
I mean, that's probably the most shocking part of this, is that they get to the end of the day and they say, oh, there's money missing. What do? Well, we'll just put a number in there that says it's there and we'll sort it out later. I mean, again, this is the type of operating practice that if you did it in your own business, if you tried to do it with your own taxes for the government, they'd haul you off to jail.
But then, given that the trillions have never been accounted for, and given that American defense spending soared to record levels after the attack, perhaps Rumsfeld's war on the Pentagon, the one he announced on September 10th, was successful after all. And perhaps September 11th was the key battle in that war.
Some might ask, how in the world could the Secretary of Defense attack the Pentagon in front of its people? To them I reply, I have no desire to attack the Pentagon. I want to liberate it.
Insurance scams and insider trading, electronic fraud and vulgar betrayal, missing money and evidence destroyed. There are at least 8.5 trillion reasons to investigate the money trail of 9/11. Curious, then, that the U.S. government's final word on the attacks, the 9/11 Commission report, concluded that the money trail was not worthy of investigation at all. In Chapter 5 of the report, the Commission noted, to date, the U.S. government has not been able to determine the origin of the money used for the 9/11 attacks. Ultimately, the question is of little practical significance. 9/11 was a crime, and as every detective knows, the first rule of criminal investigation is to follow the money. So why did the 9/11 Commission specifically reject this rule? The answers to 9/11 are not going to come from the suspects of the crime. Instead, it's up to investigators to continue to unearth the true evidence on the 9/11 money trail. Follow the money.
And again, you've just been listening to the second and final part of James Corbett's report on the financial evidence surrounding 9/11. His website is CorbettReport.com. If you missed the first part last week, it'll be archived on the WWUH.org website for another week, and then more permanently on the website RadioForAll.net. And that's the digit four. So RadioForAll.net. Once on the site, search for the shows under my name, Cheryl, with a C. And now let me tell you about our progressive movie night. On Wednesday, February 24th, we'll be showing the film Weight of Chains 2. Weight of Chains 2 is the sequel of the popular and controversial documentary film directed by Boris Malagurski, analyzing neoliberal reforms in the Balkans and the effects on politics, economics, military, culture, education, and the media in the former Yugoslavia. Through stories of sold-off companies, corrupt politicians, fictional tribunals, military alliances, the film deconstructs modern myths about everything the people have been told will bring them a better life. And the film will be shown in the Auerbach Auditorium in Hillier Hall on the campus of the University of Hartford, Wednesday, February 24th at 7 p.m. A few years back, we showed the first part of that called Weight of Chains, an excellent film, but you don't need to have seen that in order to appreciate Weight of Chains 2, although it is currently available on YouTube if you wanted to see it. So I hope to see you on February 24th for the first film of our 2016 Progressive Movie Night. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Kwame Anthony Appiah speaks on his newest book, Lines of Descent, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Emergence of Identity. Well, I'm sitting here surrounded by a number of books. I dragged a whole bunch of them in W.E.B. Du Bois on the importance of Africa in world history. It's actually an extraordinary pamphlet that I got back in 1978. And then John Brown by W.E.B. Du Bois. You know, I know how many people even remember that, among other things, he did this extraordinary work on John Brown. And then truly one of my favorite and most instructive books of all time, really, if I were trapped on the proverbial desert island, I would definitely have to have Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880. And with that, Kwame Anthony Appiah is a British-born Ghanaian-American philosopher, a cultural theorist and novelist whose interests include political and moral theory, the philosophy of language and mind, and African intellectual history. And we're privileged to have Professor Appiah with us to discuss his latest book, Lines of Descent, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Emergence of Identity. And thank you for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
Now, I have to say, it's hard for me to even figure out where to start, because, as I said, I've got all these books in front of me, and I have to say that for me, And I'm most interested in your theories on this, that in Black Reconstruction, I really saw a coming together, a kind of melding of a convergence and understanding of the relationship between race and class brought to us by W.E.B. Du Bois. And one of the pieces from Black Reconstruction that I particularly remember was when he was talking about the role of whites and white overseers during the periods of slavery. And just to read from a sentence or two and then your thoughts, he said, first they constituted the police patrol, who could ride with planters and now and then exercise unlimited force upon recalcitrant or runaway slaves. And then, too, there was always a chance, that they themselves might become planters by saving money, by investment, by the power of good luck. And the only heaven that attracted them was the life of the great Southern planter. So the aspiration of the overseer, of the white worker to the planter class, carried with it a systemic sense of the nature of slavery in this country, which, of course, there is a moral issue relevant to, but there was a systemic basis for. And it seemed to me that in terms of identity, that Du Bois got it right and began to bring this important convergence together for us. Your own thoughts on the whole issue of W.E.B. Du Bois and his conceptual framework and what race meant to him.
Well, I think that Black Reconstruction, which is a work of, you know, when he was, it's from 1935, I think, or so. So it's one of his later works. And it's at the point in his life when he has really, taken on board a very much a class understanding that is, however, very different from the understanding of the United States that was dominant among sort of communists, because he saw that race and class were not but independent vectors, as it were. They both were important in understanding and analyzing the society that had been left behind by slavery and emancipation. And so he saw that the ways in which the white working class interests were complexly related to the interests of black workers. And, of course, his analysis that question helps us to understand his view about what was going on in his own day, which was that racial divisions were being used essentially to pit white workers against black, and therefore to allow industrial capital and to keep down white wages, basically, with the threat of black labor. So he had a sense that because of that, that while it was in the interest of capital to keep blacks and whites divided, that meant that you couldn't speak of a simple class interest. You couldn't say that the interests of black workers and white workers were aligned as just workers' interests, because race was playing this independent role in keeping them divided. So I think that as I say, we have to remember that this is a man who, after his education in the United States at Fisk and at Harvard, had studied in Berlin in the late 19th century, at a time when these socialist ideas were very central to academic debate. His teachers were not Marxists; they were social democrats. But like the Marxists, they saw that class was a crucial issue in trying to understand what they called the social question, which is the question of how to bring the advantages of modern life to to working people.
I'm interested in if you could speak more to the development and the evolution of the thinking of Du Bois. You mentioned his study in Germany. The impact of left ideas and Marxism, it's kind of a remarkable convergence of Pan-Africanist sensitivities, of Marxist ideology, can I say Marxist ideology,
yes.
Socialist sensitivities.
Right.
You know, there are those who on the left have criticized him for, quote-unquote, being elitist, relevant to his sensitivities, that education was a pivotal force in the development mm-hmm. of the black workers. And there are those, on the other hand, in the right, who give us that picture of that kind, that evolution of his thinkers, and a person who I think was really one of the most extraordinary intellectual figures in the history of the United States, and the dimensions of activism, et cetera, are just extraordinary.
It is. And I think it's important to say that, in a way, precisely because mainstream Marxism really, I would have said, he thought anyway, subordinated the race question to the class question, whereas he really did his whole life think that you couldn't reduce the race question to a class question, that it was a separate issue and that it had its own importance and so on. I think precisely for that reason, we can't say that Du Bois was exactly a Marxist. It's true that he did join the Communist Party, but only very, very late in life. He was over 90 when he joined the Communist Party, and he wasn't living in the United States by then. So I think, on the other hand, as I say, he was educated in an atmosphere of analysis in which Marxist thinking was very central, and he did certainly strongly appreciate the role of class and the role. He always saw the background of capitalism and its connection to racism as one of the central analytical ideas for thinking about society. And that meant that he was always sympathetic to issues about the interests of working people everywhere. I think the role of the sort of accusation of elitism is, I think that's complicated, partly because I think that I think many contemporary people are confused about what might be wrong with elitism. Du Bois thought, and in this he was not much different from many Marxists, he thought that there was a role to be played by an intellectual leadership in the emancipation of black people and in the move towards socialism, towards a society that was organized in the interests not of capital but of the vast majority of working people. So he did. So I think that's the sort of agenda. And when he talks, as he did, about what he called the talented tenth, the idea that one in ten black, he often said men, but I suppose he should have said people, should get the kind of high-level scholarly intellectual education that he himself had the privilege of having, and that those people, those highly educated people, people who would come out of what we now call the HBCUs, the black colleges, that they would lead society towards the emancipation of black people, that it would be a movement in which the talented tenth played a role both in as a vanguard, as the people who organized and articulated the interests of black people. And I think also, especially in his earlier life, he was very much motivated by the thought that you could combat racism essentially with truth, and that educated black people could say to the racist, look, what you say about black people in order, when you're trying to justify your oppression of black people, what you say is just not true. And that's where the, for example, the historical work comes in, the work on Africa and world history, is pointing out, not just to black people, but to white people, to all people, that Africa is a continent of massive historical achievement, that when the ancestors of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were wandering around in paint and animal skins, Africans were building pyramids and developing great agricultural civilization and developing language. I mean, developing written language, writing, and a great religion. So now I think that in his later years, Du Bois became in a way more Marxist in the sense that he thought that that it wasn't really about the truth, that the problem with racism was that it was in the interests of certain people, and that therefore telling them the truth about black people, that black people had enormous capacities, achievements, great contribution to make to world civilization, telling them that wouldn't help until you recognized the role that racism was playing in advancing the interests of certain people. And this takes us back to Black Reconstruction, because it's the interests of capitalism that are advanced by keeping black and white workers divided. And, of course, there is a real stake for the white working class, even if they're being exploited by capital, on a sort of Marxian analysis, even if they're being exploited by capital, they are gaining the rewards of the system of racial inequality. They're gaining a kind of, as white people, and that there's a kind of implicit bargain there that we'll give every white person superior status to every black person, but in return, in essence, you're going to have to accept the economic inequality that keeps the white working class in its place, as it keeps black people down as well.
The multidimensional intellectual and activist character of Du Bois is really quite extraordinary. I'm going back and thinking about some of the empirical work in his work, such as The Souls of Black Folk and what he brought to us, and his plays. And then, of course, he edited the Crisis, and he was tried during the McCarthy period. And he was one of the founders of the Pan-Africanist movement. So as much as our time permits, take us through some of that incredible diversity and dimension and depth of this extraordinary theoretician, activist, W.E.B. Du Bois.
Yes, I think, he was involved in some of the major political movements of his time. He was involved in the Niagara movement. He was one of the founders, therefore, in part of the NAACP. He was involved in the first Pan-African Congress, which perhaps symbolically occurred in 1900 at the beginning of the new century. It was he who coined the phrase, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, which was both an analytical claim but also a kind of call to arms to black people everywhere, and I mean in Africa and actually not just in Africa and in the New World, not just in the African diaspora, but to people of color everywhere to rise up against racial oppression. So, and in saying that the problem of the 20th century was from the color line, he meant that people, one of the things he meant was that people needed to get together in the whole world to rise up against the harm done to people of color by capitalism, by colonialism, by imperialism. And he, as I say, in recognizing that challenge, he got involved in the creation of these institutions, the Pan-African Movement, which, as I say, had its first meeting in 1900, and Du Bois was there, continued, and in 1945, at the end of the, well, I should say, he was involved at the end of the First World War in making an appeal in the name of black people at the end of the war, when the world was being, as it were, reconsidered after that war by the Europeans and the Americans, he made an appeal against colonialism to say, look, democracy has to be extended to everybody. It's not just a thing that's privileged for Europeans and white people in North America. But at the end of the Second World War in 1945, he was present in Manchester at the post-war 1945 Manchester Pan-African Congress in England, which was really where the agenda of black liberation in Africa was set. It was where people like Kwame Nkrumah, who was going to be the first president, prime minister and president of Ghana, other black leaders from all over the continent were, if they weren't there, they were energized by the discussion there. And so he was involved in that movement, which took off and was instrumental in the liberation of Africa, in the decolonization of Africa, and in the creation of the African, what eventually became the African Union, which is the most important organization of African states until today. And he's part of that history, and it's in part because he was so crucial in that history that all these black leaders in Africa knew about him. And so when at the turn of the 1960s he left the United States angry at the persistence of racism and essentially very very pessimistic, I think, about the future of race relations in the United States, he went to Ghana. President Nkrumah gave him a home and support for his work on the Africana Encyclopedia. In fact, renounced his American citizenship, and so this great African American becomes a citizen of this dynamic independent African country, which was exercising leadership. Again, not just in Africa, but in the whole of what came to be called the Third World. And I think one of the key things to grasp about Du Bois is that because he saw racism as this great global force, he always connected the struggle against Jim Crow and racial inequality in the United States to the global struggle, first against colonialism, and then with the independence of places like India, against the persistence of inequality in the world that he associated, especially in his later years, with the role of capitalism in keeping people down.
And as we complete this section, as much as I hate to, but people are just going to have to read Lines of Dissent, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Emergence of Identity, Harvard University Press. It's a brilliant, brilliant, important work, as is The Great Thinker, Activist, Theoretician, Activist, W.E.B. Du Bois. The legacy, what do we learn today? What do we pick up and insert into the annals of Black Life Matters?
I think that for me, and that's why the theme of the book that you just very kindly praised, for me, the Du Bois is really the first intellectual, I think, to grasp, perhaps not completely clearly, but to grasp the idea that because race is not a biological thing, it's not something made by nature or God, it's something that's made through social processes, it's what we would now call socially constructed. The struggle against racism is in part a struggle against the very idea of race. It's a struggle not just against the inferiorization, the attempt to dominate and subordinate black people. It's against against theories that see black people as naturally in their place, as naturally inferior, as naturally to be dominated, as naturally below white people and to some extent yellow people in the sort of standard configuration. So I think, and that meant that he did not think that racism was inevitable. He did not think that, and he also meant that he thought that you needed alliances between black people and non-black people in order to move ahead. And I would say that there's a little bit of a tension in Du Bois's thought, because on the one hand, he sees that the intellectual foundations of racism and the theory of race that was developed in the West in the aftermath of the slavery and the slave trade, that he sees that that theory is profoundly mistaken, that it's not true that black people are either a sort of biological group that's naturally inferior. He sees that that's true. And the logic of that, in the end, is to move away from racial thinking. And on the other hand, so that's one side of Du Bois, but on the other hand, he's a race man all through his life. He's, if you ask, you know, he wakes up every morning and thinks, okay, what is this Negro going to do today? he's always thinking of himself part of the time as a black person. And so I think there's a bit of a tension. So, and I think that tension plays itself out today. We have to, on the one hand, Black Lives Matter is about organizing people who are socially constructed as black to resist the continuing oppression of the American racial system and American racism. And on the other hand, it's sort of far future view, which is that we should get beyond race thinking. So we're organizing in racial terms in a way in order to move beyond race thinking, and that produces a kind of tension, which I think Du Bois felt and anticipated, and I think never quite resolved, and I don't know that I know how to resolve it either. But I think that's one of the lessons. It may seem like a rather abstract lesson, but I think that from the point of view of analysis, it's really crucial to see that there's this tension between wanting to see black people, as he did certainly in The Souls of Black Folk, as kind of having a special role in world history, that the history of the world is the history of races for Du Bois in his early work, sort of moving eventually beyond that to the view that, well, if we get things right in the end, this race identity, which is so important to him, that governs his life, that shapes his every waking thought, is going to be transcended, and we're going to move into a post-racial world. And I think that tension between organizing as black people to resist racism and recognizing that race is itself, in a way, one of the traps, that tension is very much present today, I think.
And we're going to have to continue this discussion. And the best way to prepare for it is to read this really important work by a brilliant scholar, activist himself, Kwame Anthony Appiah, Lines of Descent, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Emergence of Identity. I encourage you strongly to read through it. And thank you so much for joining us and raising these questions and continuing the information process.
Well, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
To a lot of people, Afghanistan or any war zone countries are seen as space of violence where people cannot find any kind of joy in anything. But in my own little world that I had created, I actually was able to run away from the reality or the fact that I was attracted to men. That's all I knew. I didn't know the term gay.
Dear Mama, I have friends who think I'm foolish to write this letter. I hope they're wrong.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Malawi's High Court declares open season on gay men. A gay Afghan refugee escapes gender role prison. And McKellen remembers mouses mailed to his mother. Those stories and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending February 13th, 2016. Malawi High Court Justice Dingiswayo Madise has resurrected the African nation's harsh law criminalizing gay lovemaking. Penal Code Section 153 punishes private consensual adult sex between men by up to 14 years in prison, with the added possibility of corporal punishment. The impoverished Southeast African nation depends heavily on foreign aid, primarily from Western countries. Following an international outcry over highly publicized and abusive anti-gay arrests and detentions in 2012, and after failing to get parliamentary repeal, former President Joyce Banda ordered a moratorium on prosecutions under the law. A spokesman for the current president, Peter Mutharika, hinted that voters should decide the issue of LGBT rights in a public referendum, but told the local Nyasa Times that his boss would support the people regardless of their decision.
Malawi's Justice Minister, Samuel Timbenu, reaffirmed the suspension of the anti-gay law 2 months ago. But three fundamentalist pastors challenged its legality in the High Court. Justice Madise ordered prosecutions of the anti-gay law to be resumed pending further judicial review and warned that anyone who disobeys his edict would be charged with contempt of court. A lawyer for the pastors told the Nyasa Times that all men who were arrested but freed during the moratorium on enforcement of Section 153 should now be re-arrested and tried in court.
Timothy M. Tambo, who heads the country's NGO Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation, told the Voice of America that the ruling forces Malawi's burgeoning LGBT community back into the closet. In the most recently reported case of homophobic violence in the country, a virtual daily occurrence, an unknown gang assaulted a gay man who had been arrested in December for committing homosexual acts.
But Portugal's parliament this week overrode the outgoing president's veto of a bill to open adoptions to legally married same-gender couples. It also allows lesbian couples to access medically assisted fertility services and removes certain restrictions on abortion. Predominantly Roman Catholic Portugal enacted a bill creating civil marriage for same-gender couples in 2010 that specifically excluded adoptions equality. Right-wing President Aníbal Cavaco Silva vetoed the bill to open adoptions to those couples, passed by Parliament last month as one of his final acts in office. His last day is March 9th. The February 10th veto override was led by MPs of the ruling Socialist Party, along with their left bloc and communist allies. Some members of the opposition Social Democratic Party also joined the lopsided motion that passed by 137 votes in the 230-seat parliament. Cavaco Silva is required by the Constitution to sign the bill into law within 8 days. Center-right politician Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa will succeed him as president.
As we reported last week, supporters and opponents of the legal recognition of same-gender couples in Bermuda have been squaring off at public meetings on the issue. The local Royal Gazette newspaper reported on February 12th that the government has unveiled plans to introduce a civil unions bill for lesbian and gay couples, with the specific promise that civil marriage equality will never be on the agenda. Bermuda's High Court recently ruled that the foreign partners of Bermudians they've legally married elsewhere should have the same residency and employment rights as their heterosexual counterparts. Attorney General Trevor Moniz told a packed presentation at the Cedar Bridge Academy that creating civil unions would bring the overseas British territory in line with the European Convention on Human Rights, as well as the island nation's own constitution. "All we're talking about is giving people their rights required by law," he said. According to the Gazette, couples will have to be at least 18 and unmarried to register their civil unions, which would be available only to same-gender couples. Under the government proposal, scheduled for introduction in the House of Assembly before month's end, the couple will have to issue a notice to the Registrar General of the intended union that will be publicly notified. Moniz told the gathering that a referendum proposed by a Christian fundamentalist-led group to preserve marriage was unnecessary, even if denying the institution to lesbian and gay couples is claimed to be a human rights violation. "The Matrimonial Clauses Act has primacy over the Human Rights Act in that regard," he said.
In other news, the government of Indonesia, the fourth most populous nation on Earth and its most Muslim, is pressuring social networking sites to remove emojis that represent happy same-gender couples. Authorities fear that the colorful cartoon figures might appeal to children. The government-run Republika newspaper quoted Information Ministry spokesman Ismail Kawidu. "No social media may show items that smack of LGBT," he said, "because we have our own rules, like religious values and norms, which they must respect." The country's second most popular instant messaging service, Line, has already dropped all queer-themed emojis, claiming that it had received complaints from users. The ministry wants major global players like Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp to follow suit. Kawito hinted at an outright government ban should their LGBT emojis remain. Ismail Hassani of the Setara Institute, an Indonesian human rights group, charged that the government's censorship promotes intolerance. "Public opinion in our country is predominantly anti-LGBT," he told the BBC. "But it is deplorable that the government follows this opinion." Sexual minorities are not criminals in Indonesia, except in the province of Aceh, which governs under harsh Islamic law. But strong social taboos predominate throughout the country. Indonesia's higher education minister, Muhammad Nasir, said last month that LGBT students should be barred from university campuses if they engage in public displays of affection.
Updating our sound story from last week, New York's Ali Forney Center, which operates America's only 24/7 drop-in center for homeless LGBT youth, says it's hit its fundraising goal of $200,000 to purchase Harlem's Atla World Missionary Church. Led by the outrageously homophobic pastor James David Manning, the church's marquee is infamous for its recurrent condemnation of fags and sodomites, against whom Manning constantly rails from the pulpit and to anyone who will watch his rants online.
"This is the Lord's house. This ain't no damn bathhouse.
Right.
This ain't no fag house. This is the Lord's house."
Amen.
The church property is facing a foreclosure public auction on February 24th because its leader has racked up more than $1 million in unpaid bills. But Manning is vowing to barricade himself inside the building. "We'll let the world know what the sodomite faggots are trying to do to us," he said this week. "We're not going anywhere." The Ali Forney Center wants to turn Harlem's hotbed of homophobia into space for more housing and social programs. More than 200 young people are on the agency's waiting list for a bed every night right now. It took less than 2 weeks in the online campaign to raise the $200,000. Forney Center Director Carl Siciliano asked in a media statement, "Could there be a more just outcome to the Atla foreclosure than that the young LGBT people most endangered by the hatred and contempt Manning promotes would take over his building?"
And finally, Barack Obama visited popular Out TV talk show host Ellen DeGeneres in 2007 as a presidential candidate. He chatted with Ellen this week as the first sitting president to make an in-studio appearance on her show. DeGeneres broke new ground in 1997 with her "Yep, I'm Gay" Time magazine cover story. She made broadcast TV history soon thereafter when her sitcom character came out in a widely watched two-part episode. But ratings fell precipitously after that, and the network canceled the show a year later. DeGeneres returned to sitcom TV with another show that lasted 2 years on another network, but finally found her entertainment niche with an afternoon talk show. Now in its 13th year on the air, Ellen holds the record for most daytime Emmy wins for Outstanding Talk Show and is still consistently the most watched daytime talk show on television. The February 12th presidential visit became a mutual love fest.
I cannot thank you enough for what you have done for the gay community. So thank you.
It's one of the things I'm proudest of, because my whole political career has been based on the idea that we constantly want to include people and not exclude them. How do we bring more and more people into opportunity and success and feeling hopeful about their lives? But as much as we've done with laws and ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, etc., changing hearts and minds, I don't think anybody's been more influential than you on that. I really mean that. You know, your courage, and you're just really likable. And so you being willing to claim who you were then suddenly empowers other people. And then suddenly it's your brother, it's your uncle, it's your best friend, it's your coworkers. And then attitudes shift and the laws followed, but it started with folks like you. I'm so proud of you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
That's
true.
Really,
that's true.
I'm not really gay.
But you, on TV,
I know.
You play one,
I just
and
thought
it
would work, and I've had to stick with it because people will respond to that.
That's News Wrap for the week ending February 13th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya King Perry.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
In late-breaking news, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died unexpectedly on February 13th. The fiery conservative 79-year-old Reagan appointee was the most vociferous opponent of LGBT rights on the high court for 30 years. Replacing Scalia will be a titanic battle during this presidential election year, with Senate Republican leaders and most GOP contenders demanding that President Obama leave a nomination to his successor. Stay tuned as the drama unfolds. Read Your Mama, later in the program. Afghanistan-born gay Muslim poet, writer, photographer Qais Munhazim has come a long way from a Pakistan refugee camp to the University of Minnesota, where he's a political science PhD student. He shared his story with correspondents John Townsend and Dixie Trichel.
Growing up as a child, I did not certainly know about my sexuality. I was confused because the term gay does not even translate into Farsi or Arabic. And so I would mostly enjoy dancing a lot. For that, I was always beaten up or scolded by my siblings, by my family members and friends. But it was mostly that whenever I would hear music, I would immediately start dancing. To a lot of people, Afghanistan or any war zone countries are seen as space of violence where people cannot find any kind of joy in anything. But in my own little world that I had created, I actually was able to run away from the reality or the fact that I was attracted to men. That's all I knew. I didn't know the term gay. And I would find a lot of happiness in dancing, music, fashion, and things that are very considered taboo for men in my part of the world, but I would do it in secret. I would do it in company of my sisters. When I moved here, that was the one thing that I really wanted to experience, to freely dance and express myself in the way that I always wasn't able to do, which I really found it a liberating and at the same time fulfilling way.
Were you ever stigmatized by people beyond your family?
Yes. When we talk about masculinity, people are not categorized in terms of their sexuality in Afghanistan. It's like you were assumed you're straight, but the masculinity itself, the word is muruwat in Arabic and also translated in Farsi, which means manliness. And that's more your behavior. That's nothing related to physical appearances. And in that sense, I definitely am not the stereotypical masculine Afghan man. I certainly have attributes that could be feminine. And at that time, I never realized that because I was a kid. But as I grew up, I was always told to act a certain way in order to protect myself by my siblings, by my family members. But outside, I was always facing the difficulty of engaging with other men at like friendship level even, because they would not see me at their level. You have to earn it, and you have to earn it through how violent you can get and how much of power you have. Because in times of war, masculinity becomes just an expression of power.
Did you find that situation when you were in the refugee camp in Pakistan?
Yes, when we exiled to Pakistan, masculinity takes a whole different notion and meaning when you become a refugee, when you go to exile, because then you're not only competing against the people of your culture or your country, but also against the people of the host country. And they could have a totally different understanding of masculinity. And you all become more very vulnerable to their power because you're not in your own space. So when I was in a refugee camp as a kid, I sold tea on the streets. And that exposed me to spaces that were always dominated by men. And I was not able to express myself in the same manner that my cousins, who were my age and who'd also sell tea, they did. They were more, I would say, rugged, but I was not. I would dress clean. I would talk in a certain way, which was very polite. People would pick on me. So you're not even comparing femininity. You're comparing masculinity with another masculinities. And then taking out another man's masculinity is another way for men at times of war to masculinate themselves and have more power over you. And that translates into sexual violence against men. I know it's happening in Afghanistan or Iraq or any other war zones, because other men competing for power, competing for masculinity and also validating their masculinity, they would penetrate another man. And in that context of when you first asked even the gay identity in Afghanistan, if you're the one who is receiving, you're considered gay, or you're performing the act of penetration, you're not considered gay. You're actually more of a man. So you can see these like really power dynamics between like femininity, masculinity.
Did you have any trouble with any of the soldiers that were around?
They were more militia fighters. And with militia fighters, and during war, there's practice of getting boys as their sexual slaves. I was always scared that I would end up as one of them, because that was very prevalent throughout the country, of getting young boys as sexual slaves for these militia workers. But my family did everything at their hands to protect me from that.
Was there ever a time in Afghanistan or Pakistan that you met other gay men or another gay person that you could talk to?
You definitely, when you live in these places, that sexuality is just seen through one lens of a masculine man. You always have to take risks of meeting other men who have the same desires. Or definitely the one beautiful thing that I would always remember is love in times of war. You always actually fall in love, and that I miss when I compare to here, because here, instant gratification of your lust and all that here takes away that deeper connection you make with somebody. And I did fall in love with other men. They were in love with me. I, at least, always felt that was very sacred to me. I was scared that I didn't know what's going to happen after. If I'm exposed, I could be killed, because it also falls under honor killing, which is very common in my part of the world, that if you step on your family's honor, you could be killed, which is stoned to death or hung in public. I mean, I've taken a lot of chances. I've taken a lot of risks. And luckily, I was never caught.
I think we're alone now. There doesn't seem to be anyone around. I think we're alone now. The beating of our hearts is the only sound.
Afghan poet-photographer Qais Munhazim was interviewed by John Townsend and Dixie Trichel.
I'm Diddly Day. An actor's life is gay. It's great to be a celebrity. An actor's life for me.
Every actor worth his salt strives to be honest and true in his portrayals on the stage or screen. Hello, this is Ian McKellen, and that's exactly what This Way Out does as well, right here on this station.
Nobody can tell a tale of the city like our favorite out British actor, who revived a gay literary classic at the Letters Live performance series at Freemasons Hall in London this week. It's served here with a complimentary lesbian musical classic.
Mama, mama, what do you see when you look at my life, when you look at me? Can you hear what I'm trying to say, or can you just gaze in that blind, loving way?
Dear Mama, I'm sorry it's taken so long to write. I have friends who think I'm foolish to write this letter. I hope they're wrong. I hope their doubts are based on parents who loved and trusted them less than mine do. I wouldn't have written, I guess, if you hadn't told me about your involvement in the Save Our Children campaign. That, more than anything, made it clear that my responsibility was to tell you the truth, that your own child is homosexual, and that I never needed saving from anything, except the cruel and ignorant piety of people like Anita Bryant. I'm sorry, Mama, not for what I am, but for how you must feel at this moment. I know what that feeling is, for I felt it for most of my life. Revulsion, shame, disbelief, rejection through fear of something I knew even as a child was as basic to my nature as the color of my eyes. No, Mama, I wasn't recruited. No seasoned homosexual ever served as my mentor. But you know what? I wish someone had. I wish someone older than me and wiser than the people in Orlando had taken me aside and said, it's all right, kid, you can grow up to be a doctor or a teacher just like everyone else. You're not crazy or sick or evil. You can succeed and be happy and find peace with friends, all kinds of friends who don't give a damn who you go to bed with. Most of all, though, you can love and be loved without hating yourself for it. But no one ever said that to me, Mama. I had to find it out on my own with the help of the city that has become my home. I know this may be hard for you to believe, but San Francisco is full of men and women, both straight and gay, who don't consider sexuality in measuring the worth of another human being. These aren't radicals or weirdos, Mama. They're shop clerks and bankers and little old ladies and people who nod and smile to you when you meet them on the bus. Their attitude is neither patronizing nor pitying, and their message is so simple. Yes, you're a person. Yes, I like you. Yes, it's all right for you to like me, too. I know what you must be thinking now. You're asking yourself, what did we do wrong? How did we let this happen? Which one of us made him that way? I can't answer that, Mama. In the long run, I guess, I really don't care. All I know is this. If you and Papa are responsible for the way I am, then I thank you with all my heart. For it's the light and the joy of my life. I know I can't tell you what it is to be gay, but I can tell you what it's not. It's not hiding behind words, Mama, like family, decency, and Christianity. It's not fearing your body or the pleasures that God made for it. It's not judging your neighbor, except when he's crass or unkind. Being gay has taught me tolerance, compassion, and humility. It has shown me the limitless possibilities of living. It has given me people whose passion and kindness and sensitivity have provided a constant source of strength. It has brought me into the family of man, Mama, and I like it here. I like it. There's not much else I can say, except that I'm the same Michael you've always known. You just know me better now. Please don't feel you have to answer this right away. It's enough for me to know that I no longer have to lie to the people who taught me the value of truth. Mary Ann sends her love. Everything is fine at 28 Barbary Lane. Your loving son, Michael.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin, author of Tales of the City, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio news magazine produced by, about, and for our sexually diverse communities and those who love them.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Tanya Kane Perry, and Dixie Trichel and John Townsend contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Meg Christian sang Song to My Mama, and Gene Kelly and Tommy James and the Shondells performed some of the other music you heard. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, a video teaser for our special From Outlaws to In-Laws compilation CD, and even more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WPSU, University Park, Pennsylvania, Free Radio Edmonton, Edmonton, Alberta, KHEN Salida, Colorado, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Lobbying group, aggressive litigator, political power broker, and media campaigner. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is all that and more. Yet its tremendous influence doesn't get the attention it merits, promoting corporate interests on behalf of anonymous donor companies. I'm Sasha Lilly. Journalist Alyssa Katz joins me to discuss the immense power of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. That's coming right up. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The business class has always had great power within the U.S. political system, but that power increased even further over the last several decades. A key actor in that change is an organization that often conjures to mind local associations benignly sponsoring highways, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. My guest today argues that it is the single most influential organization in American politics outside of the Republican and Democratic parties, anonymously championing the interests of some of the most polluting and anti-worker corporations in the country. I'm joined by investigative journalist Alyssa Katz, and her new book is titled The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life, published by Spiegel and Grau. She's also the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Alyssa, I wonder if you could explain why you assert that the power of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is only dwarfed by the two main political parties.
I make that claim because really there is no other organization other than the Chamber of Commerce that has made its influence felt in on the multiple levers of Washington politics. I mean, you certainly have other groups and enterprises and networks. I mean, clearly the Koch brothers and their networks, clearly Karl Rove organizations, a bunch of others that will either focus solely on or primarily on electoral politics and getting friends elected. You have many large lobbying groups of different stripes that focus on influencing members of Congress once they're elected. But what you have in the chamber is a very strategic and coordinated effort to press multiple levers on behalf of member businesses, and to do it in a coordinated way to ensure that policies and laws that those businesses believe will negatively affect them do not get through. The chamber is the biggest lobbyist by far, just in terms of the dollars spent. It hires numerous law firms in D.C. and as well as employing its own staff to do that lobbying. So we're talking about a group that has spent more on lobbying in the past 15, 20 years than the National Association of Realtors, than the American Medical Association, than General Electric. I mean, it is by far the biggest. It's spent over $1 billion. And on top of its efforts to influence elections and to lobby those whom it helps to elect, the chamber also has a very aggressive litigation wing that, you know, if, you know, by some event laws and regulations do emerge that are objectionable to its funders, they will go out and fight to the bitter end in the courts to make sure that those laws and regulations don't move forward. It doesn't always work, and the chamber does not always win, but it's that integrated influence which is really unique and why I make that claim.
You've started to answer this, but I wonder if you could expand on how does the Chamber of Commerce operate? You mentioned lobbying, you mentioned litigation. Are there other mechanisms through which it operates?
Well, I think notably the chamber has been for at least a decade a leading purveyor and really a pioneering purveyor of what we would call dark money in elections. The chamber is legally a nonprofit organization. That's a trade association that's registered with the Internal Revenue Service. Really from the time that Congress passed the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reforms, in 2002, that severely restricted what was called soft money to the political parties and really tightened campaign finance caps and disclosures and a lot of other things, the chamber began to put itself out there as a repository for businesses that wanted to influence elections and no longer have the channels through the political parties to do that. The chamber hung out a shingle and said, okay, we're here and we're going to push the law to the fullest extent possible to make sure that we can continue to, that you can continue to support advertising and particularly attack ads to challenge incumbents in Congress who you think don't represent your interests. And so what they are doing is a gigantic end run around the established campaign finance system, the Federal Election Commission. And this was, before Citizens United, which, the chamber played a role in advancing practices and court rulings and challenges and so forth that led the way to Citizens United. But in the process of doing that, they took enormous amounts of anonymous money from, we do not know who these donors are, and put them into attack ads that slowly but surely through the 2002, 2004, through the 2010 election cycles, first flipped the House of Representatives to Republican control. The chamber was a really leading player in making sure that happened. And then in 2014 to do the same for the Senate. And the chamber has said, look, we're a nonprofit. We can take money to merely educate voters. That's what we're here to do. We're not, this is not political activity. Or if to the extent we are involved in political activity, we're, simply doing this as part of representing our members and advancing their interests. And so the chamber has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to reshape who is in Congress. And, that has really become a leading feature of how they operate. And, this is important heading into 2016 because, now they are once again poised to both defend, especially in the Senate, where there is a chance, it's a slim chance that the Democrats could capture a majority again. The chamber is looking to defend its friends there. It's also in a new kind of unique position this year where it's also having to defend its kind of pro-business friends in primaries where Republican candidates are now getting challenges from the right, from Tea Party candidates, from libertarians, from folks backed by groups like the Club for Growth and the Koch brothers, who are in fact to the right of the chamber's favorite candidates. So we can expect again, that the chamber says it's going to spend as much as $100 million this cycle as it has in previous cycles. And, it's a significant contributor to the attack ads that really, really drive elections in races that are very, very close between Democratic and Republican candidates.
How does the U.S. Chamber of Commerce differ from other trade groups, say, that represent business interests? The National Federation of Independent Business is one, the Business Roundtable is another, and the National Association of Manufacturers.
In some ways, they're quite similar, right? I mean, each of the organizations you mentioned is a trade association representing businesses. They tend to be really fierce defenders of those businesses' prerogatives against all manner of really essential environmental, consumer, labor, other legislation and regulations that has an impact on their bottom line. The Business Roundtable tends to be somewhat more forward-looking in what will actually build an economy into the future. For instance, unlike the Chamber, which has gotten really rapidly involved in fighting the Obama administration's climate change regulations. So the EPA is looking to regulate power plants and taking other measures to really stop the proliferation of greenhouse gases to the extent they can. The chamber has been viciously on the attack, going to court, organizing numerous states to attack these regulations and demanding that these regulations be suspended. Business Roundtable doesn't get involved in those type of really extreme, I'd say almost ideological, efforts to counter regulations that are really just essential for the nation's and the world's prosperity at this point. The National Federation of Independent Businesses it represents mostly small businesses. It sometimes joins with the chamber in things such as this fight against President Obama's climate change regulations. And National Association of Manufacturers is what it sounds like, right? They represent manufacturers, but the groups will often team up with one another. But they're not involved. The other groups are not involved in electoral politics in any way. They are there as a kind of membership group, a support group, a lobbying group. The chamber is a very, very different animal. It is really there to push these multiple levers of power and really ensure that regulations objectionable to business don't have a way of seeing the light of day.
Alyssa Katz, you mentioned a moment ago that the chamber doesn't have to disclose who its contributors are, but in the course of this book, you have delved into who is funding the chamber. So what do we know in terms of the industries and even the particular companies that fund the chamber and whose interests the chamber is representing?
Yeah, so technically speaking, the chamber's donors are all secret, right? This is a prerogative of any nonprofit to keep its donors secret. But once in a while, either through accident or through leaks from the inside or through disclosures from the companies themselves or through other means, we begin to get a picture of some of the companies that are in fact funding the chamber. And I'll state the big picture first before we delve into the specifics of who those companies are. One recurring theme among these companies is that they are businesses that have really toxic problems. And I mean toxic in the literal sense, in that they are polluters or pose threats to human health or in some other way create kind of collateral damage or direct damage in the course of doing business that poses a real problem for them in the political arena, right? Because they're going to be the subjects of regulation, subjects of boycotts in some cases, or real pressure on their industries to cause less harm, or even, in the case of some, to scale back or go out of business entirely. And so they in effect hire the chamber. They don't just pay dues. They pay, make significant contributions to the chamber so that those groups can remain anonymous and conduct their lobbying with the friendly face of the Chamber of Commerce as their representative, with the chamber then saying, well, we are advocating on behalf of all businesses, never even mentioning who the donors are. And the best example of this is the tobacco industry, where for decades, the major tobacco companies, particularly Philip Morris, what they have done is hired the chamber to conduct lobbying campaigns against objectionable regulations. And in doing that, the tobacco companies kept their identities completely secret. The chamber went out to Congress. In one case, it was fighting a tobacco tax that was being proposed. And they said, this is the chamber's lobbyists said this is terrible for business. What industry could be next? It could be alcohol. It could be gambling. We don't, as a organization of businesses, we find this tobacco tax objectionable. Never ever mentioning that tobacco interests were financing the whole thing, financing surveys the chamber was doing to back up its lobbying and so forth. And the members of Congress who were voting on this bill were none the wiser and ended up voting the proposal down. Or at least it never it never passed. So it's, you know, so that's kind of the blueprint of how the chamber operates on behalf of these noxious industries. And we're now seeing exactly the same pattern unfolding with the coal industry, where, you know, one can deduce based on which companies are represented on the Chamber of Commerce's board of directors. Also, like another coal company, one coal company recently in bankruptcy disclosed, you know, had to disclose in its bankruptcy filings that it had made significant contributions to the Chamber of Commerce. And so you once again see numerous coal-related companies, which include Peabody Energy, American Electric Power. You have Union Pacific, which is a major coal transporter. And in fact, the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce is a board member of Union Pacific Railway. And Union Pacific makes significant contributions to the Chamber of Commerce. So you know, and there are a number of other coal-related companies that have had associations with the chamber. And so this is, you know, what is driving the chamber now to go on the warpath against President Obama's Clean Power Plan and other greenhouse gas regulations. And the chamber is out there saying this is essential for all business. All, you know, all of business and all of the American economy is threatened by these regulations, whereas the truth is that these clean power regulations, in fact, also open up entirely new areas of the economy in renewable and clean energy that, you know, just happen to compete with coal. And so the chamber is really misrepresenting the dynamic at work here, where, you know, they are saying this is just a total loss for the economy. And they're saying it because they're representing coal companies while not saying or disclosing that they're in fact representing coal companies. So tobacco and coal are the best examples, but you see this on and on with automotive companies that wanted to fight liability for, you know, harm done to consumers by faulty products, you know, insurance companies that had similar concerns about their liability and wanted to, you know, fight to make it much harder to file class action suits against companies that harm people. I mean, the list goes on and on, but it takes a lot of detective work to figure out exactly who is funding the chamber.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with investigative journalist Alyssa Katz about her book, The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life. So you've just been discussing some of the corporations or some of the industries that contribute to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce anonymously. And I wanted to ask you, why is anonymity so significant in this story?
That's a great question. I mean, you know, look, these companies, whether they are companies retailing to consumers or companies that have shareholders to answer to or both, have to be extremely protective of their public images and of their reputations and of their markets. And if they were, in fact, out there on their own in the political arena demanding the things that the chamber is now demanding on their behalf, they would face enormous backlash that would really be a threat to their businesses. And, you know, you can just to take one example of, and this isn't even, I'm not even sure whether or not this company is a chamber member, but Target, the retailer, when right after Citizens United, when the Supreme Court made way for super PACs, which, you know, while they allow for unlimited corporate contributions, super PACs also require disclosure of donors to the Federal Election Commission. That's part of the law, and the chamber, we should note, is doing a giant end run around even the loose rules of Citizens United by insisting on anonymity for its donors. But in this case, I think it was 2010, Target happened to contribute to a super PAC that was supportive of a candidate in Minnesota, in its home state, who had made anti-gay statements and I believe had really proposed anti-gay actions. And so once consumers and LGBT activists realized that Target had made these contributions to this candidate, they rallied and threatened a boycott of Target. unless Target withdrew its contributions to this candidate. So, you know, that was a lesson learned for Target, that you don't give money through a super PAC, even if you're a company, you know, that can now give unlimited money under Citizens United. What you want to do is go through the back door. You want to go through the dark money channels. And for American businesses, the chamber is the premier dark money channel. Your fingerprints aren't on it. You don't have to worry about boycotts or customer pushback or shareholder lawsuits. Because remember, shareholders can come back to a company. If a company is out there engaging in politically controversial or risky behavior, the shareholders could come back and say, look, you are destroying our shareholder value. And that could be the subject of litigation or other for the company. So there's on a number of fronts, companies need the anonymity, they need the secrecy. And the chamber raises hundreds of millions of dollars every year from those companies in order to provide that cover and secrecy they so desperately need.
Well, listeners might be asking themselves at this point, why isn't the U.S. Chamber of Commerce compelled by the IRS to disclose contributions?
Yeah, the Internal Revenue Service regulates the Chamber of Commerce. And I actually want to add a footnote here is that the whole type of organization that is now out there funneling dark money into elections in the hundreds of millions of dollars, the same organizations that the Koch brothers use and that so many other groups are using to do this end run around Citizens United disclosure rules. The chamber actually lobbied the IRS in 1913. So right when the whole modern tax system was born, the chamber said, we need special protections under this new Internal Revenue Service so that we can collect money from businesses and not worry about interference here and not worry about being taxed or having them disclosed. And that was right when the chamber was born 100 years ago. They gave birth to this whole concept that businesses should have a kind of safe space within the within the political arena and within the social arena to make their voices heard without interference. So the protections against disclosure apply to any nonprofit organization and always have. I will note that the state of California right now, Attorney General Kamala Harris is trying to require disclosure of nonprofit organizations. And not surprisingly, the groups that are using nonprofits as political weapons really improperly are fighting back and saying that she's abridging their First Amendment rights. But it's a really bold step for California to take. The chamber has made the argument, and all of the dark money groups that have followed have made the argument, that they have two arguments, actually. One argument is that their political spending is not, in fact, political, that this is what are called 501c4 or 501c6 social welfare or trade organizations, that they can educate the public and that this is part of their job, and that all those attack ads are merely educational, which is ridiculous, but they'd argue this for many years. In response to subsequent legal rulings that challenged the premise that certain of those ads were simply educational, the chamber and other groups had to switch gears in the past few years. And so now they are running much more what's called express advocacy, where now the attack ads will say, vote against this person, throw them out of office, or they'll sponsor ads that will say, vote for this person. So now in most cases, the chamber is not even claiming that the ads are merely educational. What the dark money groups have been doing is saying that as long as they are not spending the majority of their money on politics, that they are not, in fact, political groups. And the IRS, unfortunately, has given them cover because its commissioner has also spoken along the same lines and said, well, as long as these groups are not spending most of their money on politics, they can do what they want. And unfortunately, what you're also seeing now is many groups, including the chamber, that are, you know, spending enormous sums on elections, and some groups, which really clearly are only political machines, which, you know, the chamber, as we've discussed, does a lot more. What's happening is that watchdog groups are filing complaints with the Federal Election Commission and saying, you know, these are not nonprofit groups. These are political committees, and you need to go after them. And what's happening is the Federal Election Commission is saying, oh, yeah, I guess you're right. Those are political committees. But, you know, they were doing that, their campaign, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and too late now. So we're not going to take any action against them. So you have both the Internal Revenue Service and the Federal Election Commission kind of paralyzed in the face of the dark money phenomenon. And it doesn't help, you know, that you have conservatives really fired up around, if you recall, this Tea Party scandal or faux scandal a couple of years ago, where supposedly the Internal Revenue Service, you know, went after nonprofits that had Tea Party in their names or some such in their names. And the political pushback against the IRS was so fierce that now the agency is just really afraid to regulate political activity because it's going to be in a giant, you know, if nothing else, you know, not only a political battle, but also a sort of giant free speech battle with the chamber and with the groups that have followed in its path of saying that they should have the freedom as nonprofit groups to say whatever they want, do whatever they want, take secret donations, and, you know, if it's, you know, political activity that they're engaged in, so be it. And it's just a complete abdication by the federal government of its responsibility to regulate political activity under the law.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the author of The Influence Machine, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life, published by Spiegel and Grau. Alyssa Katz is also the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, which we had the pleasure of interviewing her about on Against the Grain several years ago. She's a member of the editorial board of the New York Daily News. We are going to talk much more about the corporations and companies that are involved in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and how the U.S. Chamber of Commerce serves their interests. But I wanted to ask you about the history of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce going back 100 years. How did it come to be formed?
So, you know, if you rewind to 1912 when the chamber came into being, you know, you had a moment in American history where business was, you know, often at war with itself. And in particularly around the tariff, around, you know, taxes on imports that, you know, essentially protected certain sectors of the American economy. And you know, this became a real kind of political problem because in session after session in Congress, you know, you had you had some momentum for reform. You actually had the investigative journalist Ida Tarbell, you know, who did, history of Standard Oil, and she was like the big muckraker of that time. Mm-hmm. For her, these tariffs were like a huge scandal to expose, because what they essentially did was protected entire industries and were basically a form of corporate welfare at that time, and often resulted from really corrupt entanglements with the members of Congress who would, you know, pass these or allow these tariffs to continue. And then meanwhile, you had other businesses that were being ruined because they couldn't compete on this unlevel playing field. And so, you know, President Taft in particular, you know, who was this, you know, he was a kind of mostly pro-business Republican, and he was kind of trying to tidy things up after President Roosevelt had really been quite critical of businesses in a lot of ways. You know, President Taft came in and told these warring businesses, look, you guys have to really figure out what it is that you want to do, because I can only act on business's behalf if I have some kind of coherent agenda from you guys. And so the initial game plan was, in fact, to have the newly formed Department of Commerce kind of have an advisory board of businesses to help instruct the federal government about how they would best be, you know, how they would best be regulated and how policy should look going forward. But the businesses didn't want that. They didn't want to be kind of the president's pets. They wanted the independence. And so Taft and they switched gears and said, okay, well, why don't, you know, we talk about having an independent chamber of commerce that would be, you know, in fact, they sought the chamber sought a charter from Congress. Congress decided not to charter it formally, but it did, as I mentioned, get special, the chamber got special protections from this new Internal Revenue Service to operate as neither really the private sector, not the public sector, but this entirely new kind of animal, which was this non-profit trade organization that would combine the firepower of all American business. And so in doing that, you know, I talked about how President Taft was seeking consensus. I mean, the chamber really followed that kind of consensus building model for decades. The chamber was bound by bylaws and internal rules that were very clear that the chamber's actions could not benefit any particular business or sector, and that its decisions had to be made by majority vote, and that vote would have to go to the general membership. And, you know, what this meant in practice was that the chamber, you know, while it was certainly very, very active in things like pushing back against the New Deal, in fighting for what things like, you know, what became the Taft-Hartley Act to rein in strikes by organized labor. You know, there were, you know, you later had the chamber fighting to significantly reduce corporate taxes, which they partially won under President Reagan. So around these sort of big picture issues that crossed all of American business, you know, the chamber would pretty reliably be out there fighting, as one would expect. What you didn't have during this history, because it was really forbidden in the organization's very DNA, was the kind of advocacy we've been talking about on behalf of specific industries, specific interests, and really in opposition to other interests, to emerging sectors of the economy, such as green energy, that are really pose threats in significant ways to these legacy industries that really make up the bulk of, from what we can tell, the chamber's bigger.
So what changed in the 70s and 80s and really especially the 90s, where the Chamber of Commerce reoriented itself?
Well, you had a watershed moment in 1993-94 around the Clinton administration's efforts to get some form of universal health care. And believe it or not, the Chamber of Commerce in 1993 was really in favor of the Clinton health care plan. And quite simply because the status quo of employer paid health insurance is very costly for American employers. And it functioned in a sense as a drag on their business if they're competing internationally against businesses from the vast majority of countries that have universal and usually state sponsored health insurance. The companies had to carry all those costs on their own budgets, and this was difficult for them. So quite rightly, the chamber came out in favor of this plan. But, you know, you have had for a long time, dating back to the McCarthy era and likely dating before, real kind of ideological faction in part on the chamber's board, in part on the chamber's staff, and also just in Washington, that simply sees any kind of strong government program to advance public interest, even in partnership with business, even when it's beneficial to business, that simply on an ideological basis cannot accept that and finds that anathema to the environment that they believe American business should operate in. And so what you saw was an enormous lobbying campaign, a really vicious bunch of threats and fights. You had, in Congress, John Boehner and Newt Gingrich and others really warned the chamber that they were not going to have them as friends in Congress anymore if they went ahead and continued to support Clinton's healthcare plan. And in the end, the chamber was forced to flip its position from support of Clinton's plan to opposition, like literally overnight. They showed up, they had a lobbyist show up in Congress to testify, and he had to explain why they had changed their position, and he really couldn't. And shortly thereafter, the longtime president of the chamber, a man named Richard Lesher, resigned. And, you know, this big fight was a real trauma for the organization, and it led to a lot of reckoning on the board of directors about what it was going to be. And you had that board really decide at that point to just go whole hog and push the group in the kind of more ideological direction that was represented by this reversal of position on Clinton's healthcare plan. And so, you know, the new director of the chamber, the new CEO who came on in 1997 was a man named Tom Donahue, who had in fact worked for the chamber earlier in his career, starting up its kind of faux grassroots wing called Citizens' Choice that was out there to kind of generate letter writing campaigns and such on behalf of the chamber's lobbying agenda. They brought him back from the trucking industry lobbying group to run the chamber, and he came in there with a real a game plan to not only be, I mean, you know, Washington has plenty of conservative think tanks that were capable of putting out policy positions and so forth, but what he wanted to do was combine that ideology of minimal regulation on business with a extremely strategic political plan to actually realize that agenda. And then promptly went out and began to go to major business leaders and to go to their lobbyists in Washington and say, that old Chamber of Commerce used to reluctantly write checks to and pay dues to, that's all gone. This new Chamber of Commerce is going to be a fierce advocate on your behalf. I want you to step up your donations to us. And in return, we can promise you we're going to deliver an entirely different regulatory environment in Washington. And you know, Donahue came in determined to significantly increase the chamber's budget and resources and to put those resources into really supersizing all the stuff we talked about, the elections spending, the lobbying, the litigation, and to really build up capacity in each of those areas in an incredibly strategic way. And so really everything I write about in the book about the modern chamber since 1997 is really attributable to CEO Tom Donahue and to several of his deputies as well, who were really instrumental in building up this strategic team that could really be deployed on behalf of any corporation that wanted to hire it.
Okay, so you write, Alyssa Katz, in The Influence Machine, that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce reoriented itself in many ways in response to the legacy of the 1960s, the kind of consumer protections and regulations. There was a turn starting in the 1970s within the business class towards a more aggressive pro-corporate agenda, you know, that can be termed neoliberalism, amongst other things. And that push really ratcheted up in the 1980s. So it's interesting to me that the Chamber of Commerce took on its particularly aggressive nature, not then, but in the late 90s. Would you just attribute this to the kind of ideological orientation of Tom Donahue as the president and CEO at that time? Or could one see a larger need within the business class, a sense that an even more aggressive orientation was necessary?
Yeah, I think that, you know, organizing for mutual benefit doesn't necessarily come naturally to businesses, right? They are by their nature competitive. And we also, for very good reasons, have laws in this country that prevent cartels, collusion, you know, really the kind of business collaboration that would really pose an even greater threat to democracy than the Chamber of Commerce. So, you know, I think part of this is just, it's, you know, you have individual companies focused on their bottom lines, focused on their growth, that are just slow to react to a changing environment. And you also, you know, you can't underestimate how kind of catalyzing these 1960s movements were. I mean, it was, you really had a sense in Washington that, you know, the consumer groups, the labor groups, the environmentalists, really, you know, they were the big powers in a very real sense. And business didn't quite have a clue at that point and didn't have the leadership at that point to really effectively counter it. No, so I think you had one turning point when President Reagan came into office. But then, of course, the problem is that when you have a pro-business, let's cut taxes and or not cut taxes later on president, it was very hard for the chamber, for one, or for any other group to go out with a tin cup to businesses and say, actually, we're under terrible threat here. You should join the chamber and we're going to go out there and, you know, do something about the business climate, because they had a very friendly business climate with Reagan in the White House. So I think part of it was you know, Bill Clinton's arrival. And, you know, Clinton had the real chutzpah, right, to put out this premise that businesses could win and the public could win. And this was true certainly in his healthcare plan. It was true as well in the ways that I documented in my first book of what he was trying to do with promoting home ownership, you know, building up the housing sector and the mortgage industry and so forth, while helping American households amass their own wealth was the premise. And that's how Clinton operated consistently. And, you know, I think it's having Clinton in the White House so successfully, you know, businesses prospering under that success. But I think also realizing at that point that they were leaving a lot of money on the table, right? That every time Clinton would promote one of these policies that would give a little to business and take something back for the public, that the business's point of view was, well, why can't we have it all? Why do we have to have a give and take? And so I think it was just the sort of right political moment for the chamber to assert itself in the way that it did. And it was just also that, you know, you had that trauma of the healthcare fight that opened the way for, you know, Donahue was just the leader to make that happen. And to change that ideological orientation and to really whip those businesses into this collaborative project that they, I don't think, would ever have taken on left to their own devices.
That is the voice of Alyssa Katz. She is the author of The Influence Machine, The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life. That's published by Spiegel and Grau, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's an investigative journalist, and you're listening to Against the Grain, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So I want to ask you, Alyssa, more about some specific examples of the kind of influence the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has had on policy, on laws. And I wonder if you could tell us about its impact on the category, if you will, of environmental health, the kind of things that industry may produce that directly have an impact on, you know, the air we breathe or the water we drink.
Sure. I mean, you know, the chamber has really grown into the leading business voice in opposition to the signature efforts of the Obama administration to keep air and water clean. And they're in fact involved in two major court fights right now over one thing is called the Waters of the U.S. plan, which is meant to reassert a former federal authority over rivers and streams and so forth that go into national waterways like Chesapeake Bay, Puget Sound, where you have kind of significant wildlife and environmental resources in jeopardy there, you know, because you have pollutants running into those waterways from tributaries. And so this is a really important effort to try to establish some federal oversight over that. The chamber has rallied, it has gone to court, rallied states, and been a leading voice in fighting those regulations and saying that those are overreach when, you know, as I said, this is just reasserting authority that the federal government already had. You also have the chamber as the organizer of an effort that involves, at this point, 26 states to fight Obama's Clean Power Plan, which would establish a cap and trade system that would essentially force states to scale down their use of coal-fired power plants and scale up their use of natural gas and renewable energy.
And, you know, it allows states to figure out their own path to doing this. And the chamber has fought back, is looking to block this regulation now, and is saying that this is just an enormous threat to the American economy and to the coal business. And they are demanding that this be stopped. And this is a pattern the chamber is engaged in for a very long time. I mean, the group has not only fought these kinds of regulations in the past, as I write about in The Influence Machine, the chamber has also sought to kind of develop new ways to challenge this kind of environmental regulation on the basis of technicalities and finding ways to challenge the well-established science that underlies these regulations. You know, you had clean air regulations that sought to limit asthma-causing pollutants in exhaust from diesel and other sources. The chamber pushed a law that's still on the books that allows for the scientific research underlying the regulations to be challenged. And, you know, what they sought was, you know, this is a well-respected, heavily cited Harvard study about the impact of dirty air on the public, and, you know, really laid out what the health and death toll is from these pollutants when they're not properly regulated. The chamber hounded the researchers who produced this study for the data, and then attempted to use this law that it had promulgated, you know, through Congress to actually challenge the science underlying these clean air regulations. So, you know, again, going back to what we were talking about earlier, this is where the chambers reach into all of these different power arenas become so important, because not only was the chamber out there lobbying to influence members of Congress on these issues, and not only was the chamber involved in the regulatory process to object to the EPA's you know, regulating pollutants as it's entitled to under the Clean Air Act. But then the chamber was also passing, you know, urging members of Congress to pass other laws that would enable it to then go to court and then challenge those regulations on technicalities that it itself had created. And so you're seeing this sort of incredibly strategic use of these multiple levers of power in coordination with one another. Sometimes these strategies work, sometimes they don't, but the pattern of fighting these regulations that are simply seek to protect public health under well-established law and science is consistent. And this is what the chamber has done again and again and again.
What about class action lawsuits, which has been one vehicle through which people who have been exposed, say, to toxics have been able to demand some kind of accountability or at least compensation from the industries or corporations?
Right. So the chamber engaged, you know, through its Institute for Legal Reform. It raised a lot of money, mostly from insurance companies. State Farm was a big one, Prudential, AIG were some of the big players in this. And it raised a significant amount of money to try to change the climate for consumers out there in the courts when they seek to sue after, you know, being harmed by a product. And they particularly targeted states where they perceive judges and juries to be overly favorable to consumers and to lead to very, very expensive payouts to consumers from those companies based on jury rulings. And, you know, some of these payouts were significant amounts of money, but it was because these companies had harmed so many people. I mean, you're talking about class action suits, for instance, on behalf of everyone who had ever had their auto parts replaced under a State Farm claim, who, you know, these people all had got fake parts put in their cars by the insurer when they were being told that these were actually authorized auto parts, and these fake parts were not, you know, they were not the same as the parts that they were replacing. And, you know, the liability adds up very quickly when you're a company that's doing things like that to rip off consumers. So the chamber in that particular instance engaged in some real
chicanery around around the court that was poised to sign off on that particular settlement. It actually went in, this was in Illinois in 2004, the court had ruled that the company, that State Farm was liable. It had only, it was only a matter of signing off on what was going to be a $1 billion settlement. The chamber ended up funneling millions and millions of dollars into political campaign to toss out the judge on the panel in Illinois, who were perceived to be favorable to consumers and was going to sign off on this $1 billion settlement, and made sure to install a pro-business judge who could be relied on to reject the settlement, even though there were signs that he actually had improper ties to the parties in the litigation and was had a conflict of interest and should not have been voting on this. He nonetheless got elected with the chamber's help and with the help of other other outside funders, and then promptly voted down the settlement, and it ended up being significantly reduced. So, you know, you have a chamber involved not just in Illinois, but in many, many states to actually get rid of judges on the bench who are perceived to be too consumer friendly, replace them with friendlier judges. And then it also helped advance federal legislation that removed a lot of class action cases from state courts that were perceived to be consumer friendly and put them into federal courts where they could be assured of consistently smaller judgments. So, you know, and the other thing the chamber has been doing is promoting the use of mandatory arbitration in consumer contracts, and now is working to block some very important efforts emerging from the Obama administration to rein in this mandatory arbitration. And mandatory arbitration is simply that when you sign a contract for a cell phone or when you send your parent to a nursing home and sign up there, a number of consumer contracts will actually say that you are required to resolve any disputes through a private forum. You cannot go to court or, you know, or join a class action suit to resolve these grievances. And these forums are overwhelmingly stacked against consumers because the arbitrators who are doing these cases, they're counting on the companies to steer them business. And they know that if they rule unfavorably for the companies, that they are not going to get more jobs as arbitrators. So, you know, you have consumers coming into these situations with the odds against them. The chamber has gone out there and said, well, our arbitration is actually great for consumers. It's better for consumers, which is a ridiculous argument to make, because if arbitration is so great for consumers, then it should be consumers' choice, right? I mean, if the chamber supports free markets and the notion that people should decide what services to use or what products to buy, then by all means, if consumers want to opt into arbitration in their contracts, they should. But to actually mandate that arbitration and then claim that it's good for consumers just is doesn't wash at all.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. I've been speaking with Alyssa Katz. She's an investigative journalist, member of the editorial board of the New York Daily News. She is author of the book, The Influence Machine, The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Corporate Capture of American Life, published by Spiegel and Grau. We've been discussing that book today. Also the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us. Alyssa Katz, thank you.
Thank you. This is great.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to radio news about radio waves. Headlines from the ether. Headlines. This is Tom Bird with the radio news about radio waves. On January 28th, Republicans held their final debate before voters began casting ballots around the nation. And by our count, less than 2 minutes were devoted to internet or broadcast-related matters. Ohio Governor John Kasich was asked about encryption and said it was better not to talk about it. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul repeatedly inserted that the rest of the candidates were ignoring basic rights of Americans by supporting warrantless government surveillance. Let's hear what they said. First Kasich, then Paul.
To encrypted cell phone technology, which protects most smartphones that we all have from hacking. And it includes our phones, and it also protects the cell phones of the terrorists. Now, the tech companies and a group of MIT scientists, smart guys, right, warned that if they create a way for the FBI to have a backdoor into our encrypted communications, then the bad guys will exploit it too. And they say that this is going to cause more security problems than it would solve for everyday Americans. Are they wrong?
Well, look, the Joint Terrorism Task Forces need resources and they need tools. And those are made up of the FBI, state, and local law enforcement. And Megan, it's best not to talk anymore about backdoors and encryption. It'll get solved, but it needs to be solved in the Situation Room of the White House with the technology
this
folks.
This is public testimony.
Yeah, but I just have to tell you that it's best with some of these things not be said.
The NSA is another big issue. Ted said he was for, you know, NSA reform, but then he told Marco Rubio, oh, no, I voted for the bill because I'm for the government collecting 100% of your cell phone records. I don't think Ted can have it both ways. They want to say they're getting some of the liberty vote, but we don't see it happening at all. We think we're going to do very well in Iowa with the liberty vote.
We'll come back to
Just very quickly, I'd like to respond. The bulk collection of your phone data, the invasion of your privacy, did not stop one terrorist attack. I don't think you have to give up your liberty for a false sense of security. When we look at this bulk collection, the court has looked at this. Even the court declared it to be illegal. If we want to collect the records of terrorists, let's do it the old-fashioned way. Let's use the Fourth Amendment. Let's put a name on a warrant. Let's ask a judge for it. Let's respect the history of our country. John Adams said that we fought the war for independence because we wanted to fight against generalized warrants. Let's don't forget that.
That was John Kasich, then Rand Paul, the recent Republican presidential debate. This is Tom Rowe for Waveform Radio and WGXC.